Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Probably started in the Second World War. Think about it. All these black men, millions of black men, leave the United States for the first time, go over to Europe with America's armed forces and fight the Nazis and make more money fighting Nazis than they ever dreamed they would make in the United States. And a lot of those men, while they were in Europe, just to be real, not to be crass, a lot of them probably got their dick sucked by white women. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, this was World War II Europe, and these were desperate times, and penises were being sucked for shoelaces and chocolate and very frivolous things.
Now, the first American GIs arrived in Britain in 1942, and they soon developed a bit of a reputation. Oversexed, overpaid, and overhere was the common description of them. Carol Travers from Poole in Dorset is one of a number of children born as a result of her mother's relationship with an African-American soldier. She never knew her father, but she's been trying to trace him all her life. Fiona Clampin has been talking to Carol and to John, who's also grown up as a mixed-race child who never knew his father. Louisa Ajoa Parker has been researching the stories of these war babies and their mothers. The US Department of Defense had produced a film to educate the young men who were due to be stationed in Britain about what sort of welcome they might receive.
Well, goodbye, ma'am.
Goodbye. It's been very nice meeting you both.
Glad to have met you, I'm sure.
Funny you should come from Birmingham too, isn't it? Have you come to my Birmingham, you must come to my home and have a cup of tea with me, both of you.
Thank you, we will.
Goodbye and good luck.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Now look, men, you heard that conversation. That's not unusual here. It's the sort of thing that happens quite a lot. Now let's be frank about it. There are colored soldiers as well as white here, and there are less social restrictions in this country. Just what you heard, an English woman asking a colored boy to tea. She was polite about it, and he was polite about it. Now, look, that might not happen at home, but the point is, we're not at home. And the point is, too, if we bring a lot of prejudices here, what are we going to do about them?
It's estimated that about 80,000 American soldiers came to Dorset during World War II, and around 10% of those would have been black, so it's thought there were around 8,000 African-American soldiers in Dorset. My name is Louisa Ajua Parker. I'm a black history writer and a poet. The black men formed some really positive relationships with local people. They'd bring children to the camps and sort of let them ride around on the trucks and give them sweets. And obviously they had relationships with the local women who found them very attractive and charming with their smart uniforms. You know, they were sort of quite a hit. And they were very sort of courteous and well-respected, I think, by the local people. There were some instances of racism towards them from locals, but I think it was on a much lower scale than the racism from the white Americans that they were meant to be part of the same army with.
My name is Carol Travers. I am the daughter of an American GI who was stationed here down in Port Key in 1942. My mother used to help in a pub called the Jolly Sailor, which is on the quay, and my father used to, like a lot of them, used to go in there. I remember Mum saying, telling me, like, that he used to sing in the pub, and she said he always used to sing Goodnight Irene to her.
Irene, goodnight. Irene,
good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene.
I will see you. My father returned to America before I was born in April 45, where he was already married. On my stepfather's return from the Navy, he obviously found that my mum had had a mixed-race child, decided to start divorce proceedings, but then later changed his mind when he realised he couldn't get custody of my sister, so decided to take my mum back with me and give me a name and bring me up.
During my research, I discovered that there were at least 13 of these brown babies, as they were called at the time, so these mixed heritage children that were born in Dorset, although it's likely there were quite a lot more, because over the borders in Devon and Somerset, there were 39 recorded. In those days, if anybody started talking about it, it was, oh, no, don't talk about that sort of thing. So it must have been quite difficult for the children growing up, knowing that there was this difference, but not perhaps really understanding why they were different or it not being openly discussed. So that must have been quite challenging. But I think, you know, the fact is that a lot of the children did remain with their mothers, which is fantastic, because I know that in other places they were actually forcibly removed by the local authorities.
My name is John Stockley. I was born and bred in Weymouth, down in Dorset. You can't get more Dorset than me, except for the African-American bit.
Your mother didn't have any other children. What was the effect of having you on her relationship with your stepfather?
It was a strange relationship. He didn't like us to be too close. And when he wasn't there, if some music came on the radio, I would dance with her. She'd really go for it. But not when he was around. We were told to stop. He could be vicious, nasty, cruel. And my mother was effectively kept in a position of restraint.
He wasn't the best of fathers. I've heard him say that bastard of yours. And it was in the middle of a row when I was about five or six when he asked my mother if she had told me anything and she said no. And he said, well, it's about time you did. My mother then called me in from the garden, sat me down, explained it all and that he wasn't my father and who my real father was. And with that, I said, can I go back out to play now? You know, I think my stepfather thought it was going to turn me on my mum, but it didn't. And as I grew up, I felt quite proud, to be honest. It didn't bother me. My colour did now and again because of the stares and things, but because I was a lot darker then.
I just remember seeing the other kids at school and thinking to myself that I could make myself white and started eating chalk, quietly, not letting everyone see, of course, but I ate quite a bit of chalk.
Do you remember how old you were then?
I was about seven. And then I discovered at my grandmother's, in the larder, a bottle of milk of magnesia. I was struck by the colour of the bottle. And I just thought, this is my way, this I'll try this. And so I drank about just over probably half the bottle.
And why do you think you wanted to do that? What was it sort of happening in your life at that time that made you want to turn your skin white?
I think it was a name calling. I realised I was different, very different from the other kids at school. I remember one quote was, your mother made a mistake.
Who said that?
One of my aunties. Your mum made a mistake. Yes, she did. The mistake is me.
It was in here, like this.
OK.
Because they're best laid down, aren't they?
Yeah.
This is what was given me on a special birthday many years ago, and I've put it away up here. I said, I'm going to keep that till the day I find either my father or out about him and know that who he was, and that's what I aim to do is take it out and celebrate.
A very nice bottle of champagne.
But I just hope it's drinkable by the time I find out about him. It wasn't until I grew older and after I'd had my own family, that I then started to want to know a lot more about it and ask questions. But unfortunately, by then, my mother had passed.
What would it mean to you if one day you did find out that vital piece of, that vital clue that would connect you to your father?
Over the moon. To know that I did belong to somebody would mean the world, you know, because that's how you, it's as though he never existed. So where did I come from, you know? I know my mum played a part, but other than that, I've nothing, you know? I'll always be grateful because I know some of them were put in homes and things, you know, but then my mum, she said she would never have given me up because she said he was the only man, my father, that she ever really loved. And I've had mum's friends say to me, you know, that don't ever feel ashamed because you were born out of love and your mum wanted you. She wanted something of him because she knew he was going back and she wanted something left of him.
What did your mother tell you, if anything, about your father?
Nothing.
Nothing at all?
Nothing at all. People ask me this question, why didn't you ask her? And it was really to save her. I couldn't hurt her, I couldn't. The embarrassment of it. You know these things. Right up until I was in my 50s. So I'd say to her something one day and I'd smile at her and she would just look at me. It's as if she wanted to tell me, but she just couldn't bring herself to do it. I think it was the pain of the punishment that she'd had.
What would it mean to you if you did find out something?
I don't think I could imagine the feeling. Can't even think about it without almost getting emotional. Yes, it would be fantastic to find somebody. It would be.
Oh, is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color.
Our TV critic says you need to know about this season of The Bachelorette. For the first time, a black woman is the star of ABC's dating show. And here's why Eric Deggan says last night's episode was important, even if you don't like reality TV.
As a TV critic, I've spent years complaining about how The Bachelorette and its parent show, The Bachelor, present romance as a contrived, materialistic princess fantasy. The focus on physical attributes over most everything else, for both men and women, has always bothered me. So why did I find it so important to see Rachel Lindsay, the first black bachelorette, doing stuff like this?
I haven't even started this journey and I've gotten so much support from people.
You're so sweet. Thank you so much. I need him.
Like, I feel like I'm supposed to be right here, right now, in this place.
And don't sleep with all of them.
Oh, none of them.
Part of the show's princess fantasy involves building up the star as an archetype of beauty. She's shown being smart and personable, an all-American woman ready to pick from a bunch of guys who look like they just stepped out of an Abercrombie & Fitch ad. And this time, for the first time, that woman is black. Check out how the guys vying for her attention, known as suitors, describe her.
She looks gorgeous. Oh my God. Like, the TV does not do justice. Like, oh my God, that dress was killing it, too.
Yo, oh my God, that dress.
She's wicked hot.
And smart, too.
Yo. And smart.
See that combo.
Lindsay had to sort through 31 different suitors in the first episode. Previous recent editions only featured about 25 or 26 guys. About 11 of them were black men, and only a few Asian American and Hispanic guys. But given how much white men have dominated past shows, I wondered if producers offered up more guys so they could have more diversity while maintaining lots of white men in the mix to retain an audience used to seeing mostly white people. Many of the types of guys Lindsay met in Monday's show fit into easy categories. There was the overconfident guy.
I have that confidence in that it's going to be her and I, and that's exactly what it's going to be.
A number one seed in the bracket for Rachel's heart right here, the champion.
Yeah,
the
he champ probably won't here. Last long. And there was the guy with an annoying, loud catchphrase. Yes, he said it about 15 times during Monday's episode. Spoiler alert, he was among the 23 guys Lindsay passed through to the next round. I guess he was just too telegenic to send home early. There was even a guy who showed up with baked goods.
As you can see, I have this brownie right here.
Yes.
I just want to let you know, the blacker the brownie, the sweeter the dude.
Very cute.
Nice, very cute, right?
Very nice to meet you.
Pleasure. Take care.
But aside from that awkward joke, what the show didn't talk about much directly was race. And for some, that might be a great development, highlighting the universality of everyone's experience in a way that seems colorblind. Lindsay, who's already said publicly she ends this season by getting engaged, has downplayed the idea that race was much of a factor for her. But The Bachelorette and The Bachelor have always glorified an ideal culture that is upper middle class and white. And it has rarely articulated or addressed that in the same way we often avoid similar discussions in the general culture. I was probably expecting too much to hope that The Bachelorette might change its basic messaging on culture, class, and race in its very first episode with a black woman at the center. But I hope we eventually get to see a show that doesn't just paper over people's differences or mostly show black people assimilating into a predominantly white world. Because the real value of diversity in television is widening that world to include a range of experiences and cultures on equal footing. I'm Eric Deggans.
Population control.
Bless my soul.
Population control. Population control.
3D printers are being used these days to make all kinds of things, jewelry, artwork, even guns. Now scientists have used a 3D printer to create a functioning mouse ovary. Yes, NPR's Rob Stein explains.
So you're probably thinking, why in the world would anyone want to use a 3D printer to print an ovary? Well, Teresa Woodruff at Northwestern University says there's a really good reason.
My work has been on trying to preserve and restore fertility to young cancer patients who will survive their cancer treatment, but oftentimes that same life-preserving treatment can be fertility-threatening.
The chemotherapy that saves their lives destroys their ovaries, leaving them infertile. So Woodruff decided to see if she could use a 3D printer to help them.
It's just like the 3D printers people even have in their homes, but the ink in this case is a biological ink. It's called gelatin.
Which is a naturally occurring substance that helps form the skeletons of organs. The 3D printer squirts out the gelatin ink in very precise patterns, one layer on top of another, to create a complex three-dimensional structure.
And so we were able to use 3D printing to actually lay down a scaffold that was copying what we knew the scaffold looked like of the normal ovary.
It's about the size of an eraser at the end of a pencil. Next, they put tissue known as follicles inside the scaffolds. Follicles contain eggs and are surrounded by cells that pump out hormones necessary for reproduction. Woodruff calls it a bioprosthetic.
And the bioprosthetic was then transplanted into a mouse that had been sterilized. And now that tissue could produce the hormones, estrogens, and progesterones. And when we mated that animal, the follicles were functional. They ovulated, released an egg, and we had live, healthy offspring.
In the journal Nature Communications, the researchers report that 3 out of 7 mice that got these printed ovaries had healthy pups.
Well, our goal is to be able to develop these ovarian bioprosthetics for our cancer patients who have lost ovarian function.
By removing some of their follicles before they get treated, putting them into bigger ovary scaffolds printed on 3D printers, and then transplanting them into women when they're done with their chemo.
I think that it's really the holy grail of bioengineering for regenerative medicine.
Other experts agree.
I found this paper very exciting.
Kutluk Oktay specializes in this kind of research at New York Medical College. He says a lot more research is needed to know whether this sort of thing could work in humans, but he's optimistic.
I think it does open a new avenue in the area of reproductive biology and fertility.
Woodruff has already started trying to create human ovaries this way and hopes to start testing a 3D printed human ovary within a couple of years. Rob Stein, NPR News.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race, so we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
A student-led group at St. Olaf College has released a 74-page report on racism dating back to the founding of the school. This comes a week after the college president told students that one of the 9 racist incidents reported this academic year was fabricated. Nearly 3 weeks after a sit-in that attracted national attention, reporter Dawahi Saikautau returned to the campus, and she has this update.
21-year-old Don Williams wants to be a professional dancer. He has a year to go before graduation and is currently a double major in dance and women's and gender studies. This week, he's been unable to focus on his exams.
I am not a part of a safe community for my identity as a Black person. I am not safe here. Me personally, they have did zero to ensure my safety.
Last month, after walking his dog one evening, Williams returned home and found an egregious message on his car with the N-word on it.
That N-word has so much history, so much baggage. When I got that, history kept rushing like I was reliving it. Reliving the time where if a Black person just looked at a white person, you might get hanged. You might die. My Blackness, that identity, tells a story. It has history behind it.
The Chicago native didn't know what to do, but he began to feel that he couldn't be the only person to go through this.
I was just only one of thousands of incidents that might have occurred across the country. And so having that realization, I thought about, okay, we need as a community, as a POC community, to come together and talk about this, like now. And
so with the help of other St. Olaf students, he co-founded a group called the Collective for Change on the Hill.
We want to do better at this school. We want to feel safe.
Days later, after sharing personal stories of racist incidents, the collective inspired enough supporters to fill an administrative building and forced officials to cancel classes for the first time in 3 decades. Hours later, after intense negotiations with student leaders, the college president signed an agreement to create a task force on inclusion and diversity. Students of color saw the moment as an historic achievement in the history of St. Olaf. But then the college president, David Anderson, announced that one of the racist incidents was fabricated. In a statement, he said a suspect confessed to writing the threatening note to, quote, draw attention to concerns about the campus climate. The school said it continues to investigate other racist incidents. On a windy day, next to the chapel, junior Krista Wetzel, a member of the collective, tells me she worries the hoax letter will diminish their movement.
Oh man, you know, this could hurt not just individuals, but like this movement as a whole. But then remembering this one incident was not the reason why we're doing this. The environment of this college should not be one that normalizes these kind of incidences and one that, you know, when we speak these kind of things, other people have also experienced that multiple years in a row.
Seniors Iris Brenner and Will Herons, who identify as Midwestern white, say they support the collective and have deep empathy for non-white students.
I felt really proud of the student body and like every now and then of the administration, but really of like the students for being so impressively together with all the organizing they've done. I think I'll look back on it and like be glad that I was here to see it, because I think it is kind of a watershed moment.
It was eye-opening too, because we would get emails or hear from people that, you know, the N-word had been written on a whiteboard, and it can be easy to kind of dissociate that until someone steps up and you hear their voice and you see their face and they said, this happened to me, and like that personal connection with it is really important. And I think it was a wake-up call for a lot of people on campus. It certainly was for me.
On a different day, along the Cannon River in downtown Northfield, just minutes from St. Olaf, I visit with sophomore Catherine Hinderacher. She calls herself a conservative student who supports students of color, but disagrees over some of their objectives.
It doesn't help to just say, you know, oh, there's systematic racism, and to just keep using this word when no one understands what it means or what the effect of that is or how we can fix it. So what I think is really effective is taking these incidents of racism and proposing a solution. Like, you know, one of their demands is saying, they want some of the curriculum changed. They think they're not represented well enough in the curriculum. And I think that's a great response to some of the things that have happened. But at the same time, they're using it to push through some of just their political agenda, including things about gender-neutral housing and bathrooms and things that have nothing to do with really, you know, the notes of racism on campus. And I think they're putting a lot of stuff under this blanket of systematic racism that I don't think is necessarily accurate.
Is this campus a racist campus? No.
That's Anton Armstrong, conductor of the St. Olaf Choir. He's African-American, tenured, and has taught at the school for nearly three decades. He was also a student back in the early 1970s.
In this area, St. Olaf has done many wonderful things, and at times it feels like anytime something goes wrong, we're put up in the spotlight and kind of hung out there to dry. We are not dealing with anything that many other schools, especially schools in the Midwest, but schools throughout the country with smaller number of populations of students of color and international students are not facing. It just happened to blow up right now.
But he admits there is a new reality that alarms him.
Since the election in November, there have been attitudes that now have been given almost permission to be expressed. And I think there are people within this community, but people throughout the state of Minnesota, people throughout this country, who feel now that they can say anything because at the highest levels of this government, people are saying things and are leading by an example, which that example is, we will insult whomever we want to insult. We will say to whomever some of the most deplorable things.
Armstrong says, like the St. Olaf administration, he takes seriously the demands by the collective. In his own music department, starting in the fall, he plans to devote monthly conversations to race and diversity. Dua Lee Saikautau, Minnesota Public Radio News, Northfield.
A day of celebration marred by messages of hate at Salem State University. Just hours before graduation, officials say hackers grabbed control of the school's official Twitter page.
And the result was racist tweets. But graduates tell WBZ's Paul Burton that did not ruin their big day.
At a time of great celebration and accomplishment, graduates of Salem State University speak out against the racist tweets that were sent out when school officials say the university's Twitter account was hacked.
It's very unfortunate to hear that and to know that this is happening at this time.
The tweets began showing up Friday night, referencing President Donald Trump and several other topics like, Trump has done nothing but great things for our country during his presidency and will fix all the wrong that N-word president did.
Nigga!
Another tweet went out saying, our education revolves around white working Americans. We do not need you immigrant thieves in our school. We are better than this.
So we were able to get it back under our control shortly after midnight and alert our social media communities.
Thomas Edison once said,
Governor Charlie Baker delivered the commencement speech but did not comment on the incident. But graduate Keith Annalise saw the comments and was disgusted.
It's frustrating, but you know, you can't really change people's minds. People are going to think how they want to think.
I'm very surprised. I see a lot of different people at this school, and I think, yeah, that's very shocking.
We're appalled by the language that was used. It in no way represents the views of Salem State University and our community here.
As vile as the comments were, the university responded immediately to the Twitter hack and refused to let this incident ruin their graduation today.
I'm so glad that a lot of people weren't affected by it and just were able to brush it off.
I'm not going to let anything like that ruin my day. It has nothing to do with me.
Additional security was also in place for the graduation. The incident remains under investigation. In Salem, I'm Paul Burton, WBZ News.
To be a gifted and black.
Business put an employee on unpaid administrative leave after the St. Helena school superintendent filed a complaint about racial slurs. This happened earlier in the week. News 2's Mark Armstrong got both sides of the story.
Sylvia, it was Wednesday that a large group of African-American students from St. Helena Parish were at a Baton Rouge indoor activity park when one of the employees allegedly referred to the students using the N-word.
Wednesday, about 120 mostly African-American students from St. Helena Arts and Technology Academy were on a field trip at Area 51, a giant indoor playground near Mall of Louisiana. Bernard McPherson is the principal.
They talk to the students in a direct manner, and they also, one of them called our students the N-word, and they referred to them as monkeys directly, then also indirectly within earshot. Statements were said, you know, these the other white kids can't enjoy themselves because the black kids are here.
McPherson complained to several people, including general manager Aaron Tucker.
Once it came to my immediate attention, I took the call. They were refunded completely, you know, the money they paid for the field trip. Look, we absolutely want everyone to feel good about and comfortable coming here, and I want to make a situation right and do right by my customers.
At least one employee is now on unpaid leave while the business investigates. McPherson said the racial slurs have been emotionally damaging to his elementary students.
We're just really outraged at the treatment that our children receive, and we are requesting that those workers who decided to, you know, talk to our children in that manner, that they be terminated.
The employee will be fired, says management, if the allegations prove true. Managers say the business has never had an issue like this, and they have a diverse group of customers and employees.
You know, everyone's welcome here. That's period. That's the bottom line. This is a family facility. No preference is given to any one person over another, and the opposite is also true, that you know, we do not negatively single out anybody else over another.
The school principal says they will not be returning to the business.
And the managers at Area 51 say they hope to sit down with the school officials to discuss this issue further. Sylvia?
But if I was white, then I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
Chief Self High School in West Seattle is one of the most racially diverse in the Seattle school district. But teachers and administrators there saw that students of color were disciplined more than white students. They wanted to find out why and stop it from happening. So they contacted Filiberto Barajas Lopez. He's an education professor at the University of Washington. Barajas Lopez told KUOW race and equity reporter Ann Dornfeld about his findings.
The original intent actually was to ask questions about discipline only. But one of the things that we learned from doing this work and at other schools is that's not necessarily the best place to start. You know, we had to recognize that disproportionality and discipline is only a symptom of larger issues. So we kind of stepped back and we asked students general questions about their experiences in school, the quality of school life. We also asked them about their engagement in academic disciplines and how supports in those courses, you know, happened or did not. And then the other thing that we did ask them about was school discipline.
What did students tell you?
So one of the things that we that really stood out was this whole idea of bias treatment. And, you know, one example that was recurrent was teachers being more willing to support some students who they perceived to be more academically inclined. And generally from, you know, what the students described, they were saying these were white students.
So students were asking teachers for help and they weren't getting that.
Yeah, they felt that the response was different. It varied, and it was problematic. And I think that kind of presents some kind of tension, right, between teachers and students. And it creates, I think, to a certain degree, also some distrust, right, about whether they feel comfortable asking teachers for support.
When you shared your findings with the staff, how did they react?
I would say that there was some shock. I can recall, you know, one or two teachers just kind of commenting and saying, I can't believe that this is still happening. We were talking about these issues, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and here we are still hearing, you know, these kinds of stories. There was some pushback about, you know, can we really reliably, you know, believe what students are reporting? And, you know, my response to that is yes. We were very rigorous in the work that we did, and we felt very strongly about what we were reporting back.
What did the teachers and administrators do with this information once they had it?
They've really been engaging with the data. They're trying to understand, so here's what we're learning, and what can we do in our classrooms? What is it that I can do to make a difference? And that's kind of where that's what we're trying to get to. You know, how does this help us improve not only interactions between teachers and students, but how does it help us become better teachers? One of the things that I will say is that teachers themselves, I think, are becoming more aware. I think so. This conversation started with a group of teachers, and these dialogues were occurring, you know, with a group of 8-10 teachers at the school. And now this is a part of the whole school community. And what we can say is that regardless of all the tensions that it might bring to the school community, it's better to be talking about these issues more publicly rather than not.
Even though the outcome of this research is to be determined, do you think there are lessons that other schools can draw from your work at Chief South?
Yes, definitely. I think it's an opportunity to provide students and youth, you know, with that platform to voice. I think historically they've also kind of been in the margins in these important conversations. We make a lot of decisions and choices about youth and what's best for them, and rarely do we actually include them in this process. So I feel like this is one attempt, one first attempt to bring that voice and that perspective, and we're hoping that there's important lessons not only for Chief South, but also for other schools in the district.
Filiberto Barajas-Lopez is an education professor at the University of Washington. He spoke with Ann Dornfeld from KUOW's Race and Equity team.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Maryland's president is being called out harshly tonight. This is student activists are posting an online stream of their experiences of racism on the campus. This comes in the wake of that apparently racially motivated murder of Lieutenant Richard Collins III. Scott Broom is keeping up with this developing story. He's got some reaction, and this has really ignited outrage coast to coast, Scott.
No doubt about it, and a lot of it is happening on social media under this hashtag #FearTheTurtle. These are lots of people who are trying to get the concept that racism is an ugly undercurrent here at the university out in the open. So they are posting their experiences of this and claiming that the university of administration here has done way too little to put an end to it.
For the first time in my life on frat row, I was called the N-word.
UMD junior Clarissa Corey Bay among those today tweeting tales of ugly racism at UMD.
I just remember feeling like really like shocked by that.
The hashtag Fear the Turtle campaign with stories like, quote, being the only black man in my dorm gave a coward the courage to call me the N-word through the walls.
Nigger!
A stream of tweets alleging a racist subculture here, calling out University President Wallace Lowe with accusations that he's let it fester for years.
We can't keep protecting people who engage in this manner. It leads to events, I would say, like the death of this young man on our campus.
We believe that this could have been prevented.
Recent graduate Erica Fuentes alleging today on Twitter, Lowe once told her proposed mandatory anti-racism and diversity training pushed by student activists, quote, was a waste.
He did say that in his eyes, it wasn't something that administration had a role in preventing.
Lowe declined a request for an interview today by WUSA 9.
It hurts a lot to know this is where he took his last breath.
Meanwhile, a slow trickle of mourners at the site where Richard Collins III was stabbed to death, allegedly by a student with white supremacist ties, makes for a sad spectacle here.
Well, I'm actually a recently commissioned second lieutenant into the Air Force. I feel like that could have been me.
Well, I hope that, you know, this incident is going to open up a lot of people's eyes, because this isn't the first thing that has happened onto this campus.
Back live now at the scene of this tragedy. Again, the president here, Wallace Lowe, declining to be interviewed by us today. His administration did point out that the administration has no less than 5 separate offices that are dedicated to inclusion, diversity, student conduct, etc. And also on Lowe's watch here at the university in 2015, the university took the name Curly Bird off of Bird Stadium because of that past president's history of supporting segregation. So from that respect, things perhaps are changing here at the university, but Lowe's critics say it is not nearly enough, and an ugly underbelly of racism still exists. Reporting live at the University of Maryland, Scott Broom, WUSA9.
All right, Scott, and prosecutors are still deciding whether to file hate crime charges in connection with Lieutenant Collins' murder.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. In November, area school superintendents voted to begin phasing out the Voluntary Interdistrict Choice Corporation, the St. Louis region's long-running school desegregation program. It shuttles thousands of students between the city and St. Louis County. One of these students is Maya Petty, The recent Parkway Central graduate has been in the program since second grade and will attend St. Louis University in the fall. Her experiences as a DSEG student have helped shape her thoughts about inequality in the region. She sat down with St. Louis Public Radio's Carolina Hidalgo to share her insights.
I first met Maya Petty last July. She was handing out free lunches to kids in Baden, her North St. Louis neighborhood. She's 18 and she cares deeply about her community. It's where she grew up, but she spent a lot of her time 25 miles away going to Parkway schools in Chesterfield.
Parkway's good. Like, I know Parkway's giving me a good education. So, like, educationally, like, Parkway is 10 out of 10. But, like, socially, emotionally, you gotta think, like, at one point, like, you're like, is it worth it?
Petty's had a hard time fitting in ever since second grade. That's when she started getting bused to Parkway.
I get on the bus, and everyone on the bus is Black. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is how the school's going to be. And then I'm off the bus, and then you're like, oh, it's not like this. We're not all Black. We don't all look the same. At this point, I would say it's kind of what I'm used to, but it's really frustrating to go to school and to be able to, like, count all the Black kids on your hands.
So that's why the hour-long commute back home at the end of each day is a bit of a respite.
It's like going home and taking your shoes off. I feel like that's what it is. Because it's like when you go to, like, a school like Parkway and you live in the city and you code switch all day and then you're on the bus, you're like, oh, okay, I don't have to do this anymore. Like, I can relax. These people get me. They understand me. Like, they know what I'm trying to say.
Petty just graduated, so she's not riding the bus anymore. But she still thinks about all her neighbors who never got that opportunity.
I don't want the people over here. I don't want my peers to feel like I got where I am because I'm smarter than them, when really I just got lucky. I didn't test into Parkway. Like, it's obvious that because I'm in Parkway, that's the reason why I'm on a college track. And that's the reason why I will be able to attend SLU in the fall and to get scholarships. Because if I tell people I went to Parkway, it looks good. But people who are from Normandy or from Jennings High School don't have those same opportunities, even though they've probably worked twice as hard as I have. So at what point is that, like, it's just not fair.
Petty didn't always question being bused across St. Louis. But then Mike Brown was killed just a few miles from her house. He died days after his graduation from Normandy, an unaccredited school district.
We were talking about Mike Brown, and someone said to me, why don't you go to a city school? And I was like, why don't I? Like, I was like, that's a good question. And I talked to my contemporary issues teacher about it, and he kind of, like, sat me down and, like, talked about, like, the money in the schools and, like, why schools don't get money. And I was like, but that's not fair. Like, why do I get to go here? Why can't I? Like, why am I not in Normandy? Why did Mike Brown not go to Parkway? And after that, I started doing a lot of reading into systems that, like, contributed to his murder and things that made that okay and legal, apparently. And that's when I was like, wow, okay, we can't just say Black Lives Matter. We have to dismantle every system that made it okay for Mike Brown to die. And I think a part of that is definitely, like, the screwed up education system.
Petty wants to do her part to change that. This fall, she'll begin studying early childhood education. Her goal is to one day open a preschool and give other kids like her a head start. I'm Carolina Hidalgo, St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we have an example of the worst of race relations in our region, the bloody race riots of East St. Louis in 1917. The community is observing the centennial of that event that was actually a series of conflicts that scarred the community for decades. Joining me to take a closer look at this history, Charles Lumpkins is professor of African and African American Studies at Pennsylvania State University. He is the author of American Pogrom, the East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics. He will be joining us by phone momentarily. Andrew Theising is associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. Tiffany Lee is the co-author of Legendary East St. Louisans. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We look forward to seeing you in St. Louis a little bit later in the week, and we'll talk about that momentarily. But if I may start with you, could you kind of set the stage for us as to what was going on in 1917 that caused this turmoil?
Yes, I will. Okay, several factors have to be taken into consideration when the conflict erupted with much fury in July of 1917. A, the black population of East St. Louis dramatically increased during the what we now call the Great Migration, when thousands upon thousands of black Southerners, hundreds of thousands, left the South and moved to the Midwestern and Northern cities for industrial jobs in the booming war economy. And, of course, that meant for some type of interracial competition for jobs and housing. Now, other things were going on at the same time. The black population of East St. Louis was increasing noticeably before 1916, which is usually the start of the Great Migration, 1915, by 1910. And so the black politics part comes into play when black political activists, politicians, in East St. Louis, who have been playing or who have been doing things like swing voting, getting the black population to swing their votes to favor one side or the other in exchange for improved services and access to resources, realized by 1910 that if the trend continued, they could establish their own political machine instead of being subservient to any one of the factions that was white-dominated. Now, other factors were going on as well, namely the what I identified as, or at least as I labeled, the politician businessmen in the city who centered around real estate development, land speculation. And they had their eyes on certain areas of the city in order to improve real estate for commercial and residential purposes. And other factors were going on at the same time as well. But things did come to a head in 1917 when there were two what people call race riots. I call them pogroms for other reasons, but two of them broke out in the city. The one in May 28 of 1917, and of course the one, the famous or infamous one, that broke out on July 2nd and 3rd of the same year. Very rarely do historians have something that could be like a controlled subject in like a historical laboratory, so to speak. And hence, basically the same actors, the same players were there in July as they were as in May of 34 days before in May of 1917. And what went on was that in May, of course, as far as we know, no one was killed, very little property damage. Stark contrast to, well, the official number, of course, 48 individuals, of whom 39 were black, were killed. Property damage at that time estimated into the millions. Many homes were destroyed. At least 7,000 black residents became permanently exiled from East St. Louis, and a number of other factors happened as well. So the trigger incident was when a black self-defense, an armed black self-defense group, a neighborhood watch group, you may want to call it, basically were out patrolling their part of the neighborhood in the city's Denver Side section, and they ran into, or I should say, a car, an unmarked police car, bearing five individual white men, two of whom were plainclothes police detectives, came across the defense group. Now, estimates said up to 150 black men were in that group. Well, anyway, the people in the defense group thought there was just another group of drive-by shooters, since the black community was experiencing drive-by shooting by unknown, unnamed white individuals during the month of June, between the May pogrom and what became the July pogrom. Well, they shot and killed two of the plainclothes police detectives, and
And that got it going.
And that was the trigger incident. That was the trigger incident that set off the fighting, because the police department there, many of the police officers, of course, were enraged at that what happened to their colleagues, and refused or were very reluctant to protect black citizens, whereas they did protect black citizens back in May. Now, I mentioned the self-defense group, and that and the other individuals who were armed in the Denver side section prevented that section from being totally destroyed by mobs of white assailants. Most of the black-owned homes or black-occupied homes and businesses that were destroyed were outside of Denver side, in and around the downtown district, especially on the west side of the downtown district. What would be now, well, used to be 2nd Street, 1st Street, 2nd Street, part of 3rd Street in East St. Louis.
All right. Now, we've established that, and there's lots to talk about, but I want to get
the other guests
into the program. Andrew Theising, let me turn to you first. It seems to me like this was a perfect storm that was brewing prior to the violence.
It really was a perfect storm, and these events did not sneak up on us. That everybody knew something big was coming. And the labor disputes had been going on. The newspaper headlines for the preceding year had been very, very inflammatory about Negro colonization. And it was just conflated with all of this public talk and rumors and talk about fake news. There was quite a bit of it back mm-hmm. then, and it just stirred the wrong emotions in people.
Right. Tiffany, what of this is left with us today, if anything?
As it relates to current events?
Well, as people view it now, is this history well known today, particularly by young people, for instance, or by residents of East St. Louis in general?
No. Unfortunately, it has not been well known in this area. It's kind of it hasn't been taught in school. It has not become a regular part of just what we know about East St. Louis. Unfortunately, I didn't learn about this until I was in college. So we're trying to rectify that, though. We have been in an effort to educate the public, educate students, college students, and younger students about these atrocities that occurred.
This, Professor Lumpkins, this is something that people all over the country became very much aware of.
As far as the riots were concerned, yes. It was splashed across newspapers throughout the nation. Many of the newspapers, editorials and letters to the newspapers and such, expressed horror that this happened, especially in the state of Lincoln, Illinois, is Lincoln's home state and such. How could it happen, so on and so forth. And, of course, the reasons for the people cited different reasons for the riot, like the labor disputes, political corruption, black criminality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whether or not, it depends on, of course, the perspectives of the individuals who talked and so forth as far as, why the riot happened. And, of course, in the southern states, they said that, here, an example, racism just as widespread in the north as in the south, and it behooves black southerners who went north to move back to the south. Of course, many of these southerners who were talking that way wanted to see their labor force return instead of leaving permanently the southern states. And others cited the fact that Woodrow Wilson, who talked so eloquently about making the world safe for democracy during World War I, in fact, there's an iconic editorial cartoon showing a black mother with, I believe, two of her children looking at President Woodrow Wilson, and basically the caption, I believe, said, if memory serves me well, why not make St. Louis safe for democracy, or make America safe for democracy. That type of sentiment was picked up and expressed by many individuals across the country. Now, because of the fact that the city of East St. Louis, an industrial city, sat on the boundaries of two states, that allowed Congress to step in to investigate the riot because it interrupted interstate transport, which included a valuable war material, since the only since East St. Louis was the home of a strategic industrial plant, the Aluminum Ore Company, the only bauxite processing ore company in all of North America, and that was considered very valuable for the war effort. So another reason for them to step in to investigate the riot, see what went on, and so on and so forth. So as your two guests have said, and I wholeheartedly concur with them, the East St. Louis pogrom have so much to teach us. It's like a precursor to even today's developments, today's events, and race relations in general.
Professor Lumpkins, let me come back to you, because I was struck in reading about this with the brutality. I mean, no riot is without its violence, but the brutality, particularly in the July riots, seemed especially so, especially troublesome.
Yes. Reading about it, one gets a sense of shock, that and a feeling of horror, no doubt about it. But then, of course, I have to step back and say, I've read, and I'm sure everyone, you and the others in the audience there, have read reports of lynchings and how brutal those lynchings were, where people would take body parts or just subject the victims to incredible forms of torture or whatever. And so, in some ways, the riot contained, if you look at some individual episodes during the course of the riot, you would see actual lynchings or behavior that takes place at lynchings going on in the city. So the shock value was basically it took place in a city. It took place in an industrialized city. It took place in a city and a state that proclaimed, if not racial equality, then fairness, racial fairness. A city where the black population did engage in political activity and had some, even though there was some segregation going on in the city. On the other hand, East St. Louisans did have, and it did make an impact culturally and socially in the city. The horror was that it didn't take place in the South, because similar incidents of brutality, whether it was a lynching or even mob violence, they did occur in the South, but the nation said, oh, that's the South. I remember reading something by W.E.B. Du Bois, where he noticed that the knuckles of a lynching victim was displayed in a store, in a store window, in Atlanta, Georgia, one of the latest lynching victims at the time, that disgusted W.E.B. Du Bois. So, it was a mass lynching, if you prefer.
Well, and they were burning people alive. I mean, letting people burn to death in their homes. There was, I mean, it's just the carnage is almost indescribable when you stop to think about what was going on. That was a little different.
But Mark, do you realize what this means? I mean, you're gonna have to be a black person.
No shit.
Yeah, but for 3 years, Mark. 3 years. What's that gonna be like?
Gordo, it's gonna be great. These are the 80s, man. It's the Cosby decade. America loves black people.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The Bill Cosby sexual assault trial now has a jury, and there's controversy on both sides over its racial makeup, which only has two African Americans, that jury. The case will be heard in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, 300 miles north of Montgomery County, where the charges were originally filed. moved away out of concerns by the defense about an impartial jury. Joining us to discuss what we can learn about the jury selection process from the Cosby trial is Ellie Mistal, editor-at-large of Above the Law and legal editor for WNYC's podcast, More Perfect. Hi, Ellie.
How are you doing?
Is it legal to select or dismiss a juror based solely on race?
Not technically. Technically, there's a thing called a Batson challenge. There's actually a More Perfect episode on this, where you have to have a legitimate non-racial reason for dismissing a juror. That said, that non-racial reason can be it's such a loose standard that you can pretty much dismiss a juror for anything and have that be your non-racial reason when it's really about race.
How about gender or age or other demographics? Any less of a restrictive official policy?
I think age is pretty okay. I think gender, the same thing, where you have to have a legitimate non-bigoted reason for dismissing a juror.
So Cosby's lawyers, I understand, objected when the prosecution rejected a particular African-American woman this past Tuesday. Did you follow that? And as a jury expert, how much weight or what kind of, you know, non-racial excuse to get around it in the way you were describing in your first answer were they using?
I mean, I think one of the things that the public does wrong when we think about juries is that they just look at issues of race or gender. We just look at these big labels and think that that's all the lawyers are thinking about. Man, jury experts, these are scientists. And they're looking at a lot more than just a person's race or gender. They're looking at a person's experiences. And they're really trying to get beyond just the race and gender. So in this situation, I'm sure that there are lots of reasons why the Cosby lawyers wanted this particular black woman on the jury. I'm sure there are lots of reasons why the prosecution didn't. And I'm sure that they can find a kind of legitimate non-racial reason for not wanting her to be on the jury. She could have I have no knowledge about this particular person, so I don't in any way mm-hmm. want to cast aspersions on her or anything. But, you know, if you're a prosecutor in this case, you might look at – I'll put it like this. I've been to the cookout where you meet women of a certain age and they will say, you know, son, to me, you know, son, I was around in the 70s and you didn't drink nothing from nobody, right? That kind of person is exactly the kind of person that the Cosby defense lawyers want and the prosecution does not want.
Like they shouldn't have taken that drink that turned out to be spiked,
yeah,
et cetera. What about gender? The jury here is made up of 7 men and 5 women. In cases of sexual assault, do men and women tend to vote differently?
It has less to do with your gender and more to do with your experiences. So one of the ways that I would put it is, again, an expert jury consultant should be able to look at me, look at my jury questionnaire, and know pretty much before I open my mouth that I am not the kind of brother to bring the, oh, I was accused of rape by 40 women because of race. Like, I'm not the kind of black person to make that argument to. And you can figure that out based on my questionnaire, right? Similarly, there are so again, I'm a man. Does that mean so if you thought that, like, I would be more sympathetic to Bill Cosby because I am male and I am black, that would be wrong. And again, the experts can figure that out long before I sit in a box.
So complete the profile for me. If you were the defense attorney or the prosecutor in this case, who would your ideal juror be?
So I think if you're Cosby's defense, and I just want to say that I find the opening salvos that he's made borderline jury tampering. The silent forever, and then all of a sudden he's coming out with these interviews. All of a sudden his daughter's out there alluding to the specter of race as if somehow that's a real reason why all these women are accusing him. I find that line of defense pretty gross. However, that's probably his best defense. His best defense is probably to try to gin up some racial controversy here. And so in that vein, I would be looking for people who were susceptible to that argument. That might be black people. That might be white people who you can find a white person who's you know, really, really wants to understand the plight of the really rich and famous black man who's been taken down by the Illuminati. You can find that white person and you can put them on that jury. So that would be, you know, those would be the kinds of people I'd be looking at.
Ari in Midwood, you're on WNYC with Ellie Mistal. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Brian. I was just wondering, it seems a little weird that the Cosby side seems to be trying to get more African-Americans on and ginning up this kind of racial angle when this all started with Hannibal Buress basically insulting Cosby and bringing up the rape allegations, because Cosby is not very popular by, like, sort of, at least in the African-American community. He's been, you know, he lectured them about pulling up your pants and all that stuff. So it seemed a little opposite of what their strategy should be. Now he's playing the, you know, I'm being victimized by white people card. It seems it's exactly the opposite of what he's been doing for decades, isn't it?
Well, first of all, I don't think that Cosby lectured them. I think he lectured lots of people. But I take your point. And I think that this is one of the reasons why I think what the Cosby lawyers were doing has less to do with who they want in the jury box and more to do how they want the public to perceive the jury. Right? Cosby has two battles that he's trying to fight at the same time. One is the actual court case. The second one is the court of public opinion. Right, and I think there was a quote from one of his lawyers that they already feel like he's lost in the quote in the court of public opinion, and he has to prove his innocence in the court of public opinion. Right, so one of the ways to win in the court of public opinion is to say whatever happens with the verdict. Oh, this jury, 10 white people, only 2 black people. See what happened to me. I think that's more of a public play. I think that the caller Ari is accurate. To suggest that, and it's kind of something that I'm trying to say, that just shoving in black faces on the jury without any other kind of understanding of their background or experience is not a good strategy for Cosby's defense team. And I don't think that's what they're doing.
212-433-WNYC and Joan in the East Village. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hi. Yes, I wanted to ask the speaker if you're aware of any other criteria that are being used other than demographics. For example, I know a very skilled jury specialist will use things. Well, the O.J. Simpson trial, I remember reading extensively. They had a very sophisticated, very professional jury specialist. I'm sure that Cosby has one, too, considering the resources he has.
Yep.
And I remember reading extensively how she chose the jury. She didn't just ask questions like, did anyone in your family ever get killed, or were you a big football fan? She had them write extensive essays, and one of the things she looked for in their essays was whether they used the language I feel or I think. And I thought it was very telling that she chose people who always said, well, I feel this and I feel that, rather than I think this and I think that, because it meant that probably she knew the facts were not on Simpson's side, and people who get their ideas by thinking would be against him, and people who use their feelings to make judgments might be for him. And I thought that was fascinating. I was wondering if you know of any of those specifics, and do you know who the jury specialist is? And I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Joan, thank you. What an interesting call. Do you know what she said to be true, like that distinction between thinking and feeling types, or you can ask jurors to write essays, things like that?
Yeah, well, you can ask jurors pretty much anything you want, right? So that's absolutely true.
Prospective juror to write an essay?
You can have extensively long questionnaires. You can ask them questions like literally in voir dire. You can have them fill out forms. The judge can ask them questions. You can do quite a lot. And remember, most people don't want to be on the jury anyway. So they're always a lot of people are trying to get out of it. I think the call brings up two kind of important points that are kind of hanging over this trial in an important way. One is that, like, everybody is woke again to OJ. Like, OJ is back in the news in a real conscious way for a lot of people, and with the benefit of history, people are kind of thinking more about, like, well, how did that actually happen? And what people are realizing is that, yeah, there are these things called jury consultants. OJ was 20 years ago. The science on jury consulting has improved along with our science on everything else. Jury consultation is, you know, it's one of those things that's, it's not just an art, it's a science, right? We can know quite a lot, we can guess quite a lot about a person if we ask the right questions, which is again why I say, and again to the other kind of specter that I think Joan's question brings up and that OJ brings up, this is so much more than just, is the person black? Is the person white? Is it a woman? Is it a man? It's so much more. So much more is going into that from the defense side and from the prosecution side. And so we can't know how balanced or biased the jury might be just by looking at the racial breakdown of the jurors. There's much more going on.
It's tempting, I guess, to make comparisons, which might turn out to be facile, between this and the O.J. Simpson trial. Two black male celebrities who try to de-emphasize their race in their public personas, and then they get into trouble for, you know, these serious crimes.
And suddenly they're black again.
But I mean, you're saying how you don't want in jury selection to stereotype the jurors and overgeneralize because it depends on who the individual is. But then I remember from the end of the O.J. Simpson trial how white America and black America in general seem to have such polar opposite reactions to the verdict.
Yeah. I think some of that was actually because of what our different Americas looked at the trial differently, looked at the setup differently. And I think that's the other thing that Cosby is trying to do here. It's the setup. It's the other specter. I said OJ is one specter hanging over this case. You know who the other specter is? Donald Trump. Okay?
Why?
Because it turns out that if you are accused of sexually assaulting a boatload of women in this country and you're white, you can still be president. If you're accused of sexually assaulting a boatload of women in this country and you're black, you're not allowed to sell Jell-O. And that is a real racial disparity that people have noticed. The thing is, the corrective for that is not to let the black guy skate free. It's to hold the white guy accountable. Now, there are going to be black people who are more like me, who see it in that, who kind of frame it in that way. There are going to be black people who frame it in a different way, who frame it in a, well, if Trump can get away with it, why can't Cosby get away with it? If Roman Polanski can get away with it, if Woody Allen can get away with it, why can't Bill Cosby get away with it? There are going to be African-Americans and minorities in general who feel that mm-hmm. way and who look at the trial through that lens.
Because that's where the grievance seems to rest.
Exactly. Whereas there will be white people who are woke to that disparity too, but there will be white people who think like, oh my God, this is so obvious. So all of those things are going to be in play as the trial is going through. That's what his defense team needs to happen, because if that doesn't happen, then all you're left with is 40 odd women accused him of something. This one woman is the only one that was able to bring a case against him. Let's go get him. Like if you don't get into that subcutaneous level, then it's real tough for Cosby to ever get his reputation back in the court of public opinion, whatever happens in the court of law.
So does anything we've been talking about today and anything that happens in this trial going forward relate to race and criminal justice for ordinary folks? Because obviously race and criminal justice, you know, have so much complicated interplay in so many disquieting ways. Do we learn anything from this about that, or is this in its own category because of who the defendant is?
No, I think there's more, right? This is going to sound weird if you haven't been really listening really closely, but for everything I just said about how it's more complicated than that, and it's not just about race, and it's not just about gender, you charge me with something and put me in front of a jury with 10 white people and 2 black people, I'm going to be pissed off. That ain't right. And I think one of the things that Cosby is showing is that even a person like Bill Cosby can't actually get a racially balanced jury for whatever that's worth. That's a problem. They had to move the case out of his home, out of where the allegations happened, out of his home, not because the defense wanted to move it. If anything, if you're the defense lawyer, you kind of want a person who's famous in their community to be tried in their community. They had to move it outside the community because they knew they couldn't get anything approaching racial balance on the jury where Cosby lives, right? That's a problem. Not every defense lawyer is able to get a change of venue in situations like that. So, yeah, I do think that the way juries are selected and the things that high-priced jury consultants are looking for absolutely relates to how an average person, an average black person, and their hurdle for getting any semblance of a fair trial.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean We're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Top tonight, we head to the University of Maryland. Now, we're learning the on-campus murder of an African-American man may be a hate crime.
Richard Collins III had just been commissioned a second lieutenant in the Army. The Bowie State student was out celebrating with friends early on Saturday.
And that's when police say this man, a University of Maryland student, stabbed him in a random, unprovoked attack.
Fox 5's Lindsay Watts has been following this story. She is live on campus tonight with new details. Lindsay?
Lauren and Jim, this is the area where Second Lieutenant Collins was standing with his friends when he was attacked. Candles are burning in his honor here tonight. What we've learned from police is that when the suspect came up, he told Collins to step left, basically to get out of his way. And when Collins refused, he was stabbed. University police say they have since learned that the suspect, Sean Urbanski, is part of a racist group on Facebook. And they've now brought in the FBI to help investigate whether racism was a motivator in this murder. He had taken an oath to defend our country and all of us. Second Lieutenant Richard Collins III wanted to follow in his father's footsteps in the U.S. military. He was part of the Army Intelligence Division, set to graduate from Bowie State University later this week.
And a young man, his career was about to take off. He was out celebrating his new commission and when his life was taken that night.
We met the family's pastor at Collins' home in Calvert County. Relatives too heartbroken to speak.
This was a good kid, and he was going places. He was going places, and he had high aspirations to achieve all the goals that he set before him as far as his military career. And we're just devastated that his life has just been taken away with this senseless act of violence.
Police say Collins was visiting with two friends here at University of Maryland. They were waiting for an Uber early Saturday when student Sean Urbanski approached. Witnesses say he was screaming.
And then he said to the victim, step left if you know what's good for you. The victim looked at him, puzzled, with the other friends of his, and said no. It was then that Sean Urbanski stabbed the victim in his chest.
Police say Urbanski never left the crime scene and was arrested at this bus stop. Investigators later found that he belonged to a racist group on Facebook, hateful toward women and minorities.
And especially African Americans. Which brings up questions as to the motive in this case.
The FBI is now assisting with digital forensics to see what else Urbanski was involved with online. We went to his Anne Arundel County neighborhood where he grew up and had worked at a local bowling alley. No one answered the door at his home. A neighbor told us he's known Urbanski since he was a child and was stunned by the allegations. As students grapple with the horror on their campus,
our students are afraid. And believe me, I understand that.
A family grieves for a life with so much promise lost so senselessly.
He loved his family, he loved people, and he loved God. And we're in shock at what has happened to him.
There's a vigil being planned for Second Lieutenant Collins tomorrow. We'll keep you updated as we learn exactly where and when that will be held. Live in College Park, Lindsay Watts, Fox 5 Local News.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 27th, 2017. So I have been told. Let me say it at the beginning of the program this week and at the end, because I know this is a quote-unquote holiday weekend, at least for folks in the States. People might not have to go to work on Monday, so a lot of people, and it's warm, it's beautiful, lovely day out here in Seattle in the 80s. We don't have all that humidity, so it is gorgeous Saturday out here in Washington State, and since it's only evening, early in the evening, it's still bright, sunny, beautiful, but I know folks are going to be partying and all that this weekend. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. If you are going to engage in any of those frolicking and getting out and enjoying yourself this weekend, fine. Just make sure that you have a code. If you are going to consume any alcohol or whatever else, I would say make sure that you're not going to be in the presence of whites. I personally would not encourage victims of white supremacy to be under the influence and then be put on the spot where you might have to talk to a race soldier. Always can be a dicey proposition, so I would encourage that. I would encourage to get to one spot and stay. I am sure I'd be willing to bet my last dollar that they're going to have a lot of sobriety checkpoints out this weekend, probably all the way through Tuesday, and they tend to do that sort of thing disproportionately in areas where black people live. So my recommendation, stay sober. If you can't do that, at least be codified so that you do not make any extra unnecessary trouble for yourself under the guise of celebrating Memorial Day weekend. This here, compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have commentary you would like to share, audio clips, any other news that took place over the last 7 days. If you have counter-racist suggestions, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A couple things before we get started. We will be here on Tuesday of this week. We have a white person coming to the broadcast. He wrote the book Who Lynched Willie Earle. He grew up in South Carolina and said he wrote this book not only to talk about this 1947 lynching of Willie Earle, but also to talk about his own practice of white supremacy. And that's the word that he used in the book. But he'll be here Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Also, invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested 8+ years. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy, and helping victims of white supremacy accurately understand what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. Extra thanks to all the folks who've nabbed items off the wish list. Appreciate that as well. We've had that for about 8 years as well. Got my other solid state hard drive installed that this week. That has been great, making sure we don't have any tech problems as we roll here on the cows. And I even got my brand new extra comfy slippers so that I can mitigate my stress as a victim of racism. But huge thanks to all the folks who've helped out with the wish list. It's posted on the blog and it's listed at Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. With that, I will try to get the folks on the phone lines. The only quick things that I will add in with this week, the whole Bill Cosby trial and what have you, pretty sure that that's going to be just a whole dismal affair, that whites will do a lot of racial theater with this whole antic, whichever way it goes. If it's like Michael Jackson and he ends up being acquitted at the end, and, you know, still all this damage to his reputation and just a whole anti-black campaign. If he's convicted, well, you already know we get to go to work. And told you, niggers just out raping, can't control yourselves. Just told y'all. I can just see whites having a great time. They benefit either way with any of these sorts of incidents, and can get a lot of black people on the defensive talking about this and getting us to feel bad, which probably is a big part of all of this. I would say for people on the job, this is another case, like when we talked about the election and some of the other, when they were having all the police shootings, I wouldn't have anything to talk about this. I would think particularly people in the Pennsylvania area, this will probably be coming up more likely to come up in your workplace and what have you. One, I wouldn't have anything to say. On the job, if white people want to talk, oh, man, that Cosby, I used to love his show, but, man, now he's got all that. I wouldn't have anything to say. I wouldn't be upset about it. Back to work. That's the way that I would function with all of that. Also wanted to get in. It seemed like there were a lot of incidents. I didn't even play all of the different reports that I found about white supremacy racism in the schools. We had a plethora of them in the sound clips, but there were more than that. And the academic school year is supposed to be coming to an end for 2017. At least I thought within the next few weeks, folks are graduating and, you know, plotting what they're going to do with their summer vacation and what have you. And I guess they wanted to make sure that they got all the Negro children, got a good beating or mistreatment of them before they, you know, disappear for the summer and they won't have an opportunity to terrorize them for a few months. But it seemed like a massive uptick. And again, just to emphasize the importance of talking to your children about racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, because racists are going to be attacking them, have already started attacking them. So I want to make sure that we equip them with information so that they can be less confused, not surprised, and able to protect, defend themselves as best they can. I'm going to try and see if we can get a program on the East St. Louis race riot, quote unquote, from 1917, act of white terrorism. I'm going to try and see if we can do a program on that. Very important incident. Lots of those incidents, I think I've said consistently, these incidents of white terrorism where whites come and brutalize a whole lot of black people and kick them out of town and what have you. These incidents have happened over and over and over and over. That should be at the center of any dialogue or discussion about whites going in and killing, brutalizing black people. And I really appreciated in that segment the black author making the point that this incident was just like a mass lynching, which is something that whites did all the time anyway. They just did it on a grander scale with this incident that happened in St. Louis. Pause for Michael Brown. With that, we'll go ahead and get to the callers. I can weave in my few other comments as we mosey on down through the callers. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, suggestions, that way everybody can get an opportunity to share. For this particular program, I again encourage, request that people not use metaphors. It's been my experience that frequently conversations on racism, whites, they will use a lot of metaphors. When they use these analogies, comparisons, similes, they will equate two things that are not equivalent. They do this all the time, especially with racism, and it just spreads confusion. That is a tool of a master deceiver, to compare things that are not alike. Victims of white supremacy, we've been around racists. A lot of times we pick up some of their habits, bad habits, unfortunately, and we are still learning. We are not experts on white supremacy racism. So many of us, Gus T. Renegade especially, in trying to articulate our thoughts, we will use a metaphor or analogy in the hopes that that accurately conveys our thoughts. Often it does not. Same thing. It just promotes confusion and comparing items that are not similar and or just not being explicit, clear about what it is that you want to say. For this broadcast, if we could just be direct, explicit with what we want to say. Much obliged. I will prompt about the metaphors. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the Cosby situation myself. There's a lot of people that I know, and it is a very big problem. They already have criminalized Bill Cosby, and that just kind of shows the lack of understanding of how the legal system works. So a lot of people who are talking about you know, they want justice and they want due process, doesn't even know how due process works. And that's all I wanted to share.
Right on. Innocent until proven guilty. Innocent until proven guilty. That's what it's supposed to be. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I wanted to comment on the conversation that they were having at the very beginning of the call where they were, the students were saying that people should have their eyes open to things of that nature. Racist white supremacists already have their eyes open. No one's stupid to racism, white supremacy. And that's why if you go back to the whole setup of the plantation, which is what this nation is founded on, the ignorant white folks were the ones causing the most pain and the most damage to the black people because they interacted with them on the most on a daily basis. So sorry to everybody who feel like racists are innocent. They're not innocent. They're not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. They are mass deceivers. They seize the opportunity to cause confusion, pain, and they love seeing black people in pain and hurting. So don't let them see you cry. Don't let them see you frown. Keep your poker face on and just stay codified. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Appreciate that. I believe poker face might be a metaphor. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we've not heard from, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, hello?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing? I was, you know, it was funny. I didn't really know how to feel about the whole Bill Cosby thing. I was one that kind of took offense to the pound cake speech, and that was kind of, you know, but before, you know, I was introduced to Francis Cress Welsing, Millie Fuller, Gus T. Renegade. I think I have a little bit more understanding, and I'm just a little bit more patient when it comes to black folks. So, you know, now that, you know, Bill Cosby defense is, you know, going the racial approach. You know, I really don't know how to feel. You know, some people would say this is Bill Cosby wake up call. So I'm like, okay, when people say that, you know, are we supposed to be joyous that he had this wake up call? Like, you know, what does that mean? As far as like him, you know, now he's being aware or he's being awakened to race now that is affecting him. As far as the young man that was stabbed, even at a younger age, Gus, I've always felt uncomfortable surrounded by white people. You know, when I'm from New Jersey, I grew up in Newark. Newark is a what we consider a high crime area. You know, it's a rough area of New Jersey. So when my grandmother moved to the suburbs, funny, I felt more uncomfortable around white people than, you know what I mean, than if I in Newark, you know, where you had to be on guard because it was a high crime area. I say that to say this. I've really never put my guard down when it came to white people. I mean, and it's not even like during that time, Newark, New Jersey was heavily populated with black people. So after the riots, Newark went through white flight. So me growing up, I really didn't grow up around many white people other than if you've seen a white person in the police department or schools. But at that time, I mean, Newark morphed into a chocolate city. So even your police officer was black, even your teachers was black. Now that happened, I do find myself more alert. I work in New York City. There was an incident in New York City where a gentleman was stabbed by a white supremacist. I mean, it's safe to call him that. So, but it's just, you know, how do you bring awareness to, you know, other victims. that, you know, that they should be on guard, you know, because a lot of times I find that, you know, black people, even with the climate and you see all the police shootings and other incidents like that, you know, black people are still very trusting of white people. You know what I mean? Clearly some, I don't mean to generalize, but will give, you know, a smiling white person more of the benefit of the doubt than a black person. And I understand that that's also the condition of white supremacy. So I don't have any questions. I'm just kind of like going on a rant. Also, one more thing I wanted to get the guest and the host opinion on. My cousin called me today, and he was kind of uneased. He said that he went into a Walgreens, and when he went to a section, he went to get a wave cap. So when he went in that section, all the wave caps had locks on them. Now, mind you, these are flimsy plastic wave caps. Usually you have razors, like shaving razors in locks. But he was kind of uneased that the wave caps had locks on them. This is a $2 wave cap. So he brought it to the attention of the clerk. He asked her, why is the wave caps locked away? And she proceeded to say there's a lot of items that's locked in a plastic lock. And he says, I'm looking around. I don't see anything but the wave caps. So, I mean, he's codified. He listened to you, Gus. He just got finished the ISIS paper. So his suspicion is always on 100. I want to ask the audience, Gus, would you look at that suspicious if you went to a store and an item that's normally used by black people is in some kind of safety lock?
Probably. That seems logical.
Right. All right. That's all.
Other folks can share their thought. But, yeah, that seems very logical to me. I think other people have noted the same pattern where they have either it'll be increased security or, like you said, they'll have a lot of products locked away, just a lot of things if it happens to be an area with a lot of black people where they will justify it. Well, you know, niggers steal. Got to nail everything down to keep them from stealing it. That's pretty common, I think. Other folks we have not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers and the listeners. This is a female caller from New York, transplanted into South Carolina. Hope everybody is doing well, in spite of. Just a couple of things. I have wrote down a few things, observations from the clips, but I just wanted to make a couple of comments on two things that were said recently, one by the gentleman who just spoke regarding security on the wave caps. I have seen here in South Carolina, which recently different counties allowed for alcohol to be sold on Sundays. That was a huge thing here because, you know, down here in the South, we got something called the Blue Laws. And that was a big, big thing. So I recently saw a liquor store that had literally locks on every bottle. I had never seen nothing like that before, and I was wondering, like, how was that made? And, like, you know, I'm sitting around the house, and I'm thinking about nothing because I could be rich. had I thought about something like that, it literally had a lock on every bottle. And the gentleman who was charged with being the one who had contact with the customers was black. But the woman behind the counter at the register was a non-black, non-white person. I guess she was what you might call East Indian. Have a lot of that going on here in the South, as with everywhere else. We have these East Indians and these Asians behind the cash register, but when it comes to making a contact with the niggers, it's got to be one of us. So I just wanted to say that. The second thing was that, Gus, you mentioned how there was an uptick in the children who are being released from school and the racist incidents that they had encountered. So I just wanted to celebrate the fact that my son made it through his second year at his white private college in New York City without being damaged too much. And I'm very glad to have him home with me here in South Carolina for the summer, because he usually stays on that campus and works. But he's here with me for the summer. Of course, I had to smudge him down at the door, but, you know, that's a whole other story. And the fact that the reason why he's home, I just wanted to mention the fact that there's something in New York called the Empire Scholarship. And I don't know if it was talked about on the program, but every college, every state college in New York, in the SUNY state university system, has free tuition for anybody making under $132,000, which is everybody, right? So it's not the room and board that's free. It's tuition that's free. So I look at that along with the fact that the SATs were recently revamped. In addition to the fact that many schools no longer even need SAT scores, they ask you on the applications, do you want us to consider your SAT scores? So all of this always happens when black people make gains in education. Okay, so now and there's a lot of white people in New York State college system who are now going to get free education. Okay, many of them weren't able to afford college before. And the New York State college system is huge. It goes like all the way from New York City, even the Long Island, Staten Island, all the way up to Canada. A lot of schools. So all of these white people are going to be able to go to school free of charge. And I think that coincides with the fact that the SATs were recently revamped and black people just banging it out as far as education is concerned with the SAT scores and with the scholarships and everything else. So I think that that's a strategy on the part of the supremacists. But getting to the clips regarding the 3D printers using to reproduce ovaries for cancer patients, I think this is a form of high-tech harvesting. I wanted to know, who are these cancer patients? Are they white women? And are the ovaries that are being reproduced copied? Are these of white women or black women? I just think of Dr. Frances Fess Welsing and how she talks about how the numbers are down and they're constantly declining. And I don't think about a conversation I had with one of my clients who was a nurse who told me that you would be alarmed to know the number of white women who are born without reproductive organs, you know, because they're basically breeding themselves out. So a lot of white women don't even have ovaries. They have one ovary. They have a dysfunctional uterus, or all kinds of things is going down with them. So this is something, a strategy, of course, to keep their numbers up. And in my development, I've always been taught about how a black woman should really revere her womb and how her reproductive system, and how it is the most precious thing on the planet. And that goes in line with what Dr. Cambon talked about on your show recently, when he talked about how we are the highest beings, black women are the highest beings on the planet, and we should always be mindful of that. And the last thing was regarding words, and how Mr. Fuller says we should always pay attention to words with regarding the Cosby case, and how that caller for that talk show talked about how she knew the jury specialist in the O.J. Simpson trial, and how the words were analyzed for the prospective jurists with regard to their essays, and the words that were analyzed, whether or not they used the words "I feel" or "I think." So that's the perfect example of how white people have mastered the skill of using words, and how they use them to uphold their system and to make sure their goals and their needs are met. And I think that we would be at an advantage to really keep that in mind whenever we are requested to write for any examinations, for jobs, for schools or entrance examinations or anything of that nature. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Congratulations to your child and his academic success. Glad he made it through another term and got back to you safe, or safe as can be under the system of white supremacy. I remember she told us about she used reparations.me to get airfare for her son, if I remember correctly. And that also, I thought, was a great point about the importance of words and paying attention to, do you say "I think" or "I feel," and that being able to tell you a lot about how a person processes information. Like, excellent, just the use of words. Before we nab some of the other folks that dialed in, also, I thought it was important, that segment on The Bachelorette, a show I've never seen, I thought it was really important, and the people that have listened to Mrs. Coretta Scott King's autobiography, the portion yesterday where she talked about her daughter when she was a child and she was in a play, and in this play she was going to be a prostitute with poor English and she was going to kiss a white person. And then in The Bachelorette, in that segment where they were talking about having a black female on The Bachelorette, I don't know if people heard it, but there was a portion from the show where somebody told her, they said, make sure you don't sleep with all of them. Reminded me exactly of that portion of Coretta Scott King, and consistently the way that black females in particular have to, well, all of us really, but black females have to be projected as being some sexually deviant, overly sexed, gotta be. It's gotta be some sort of trashy way to snipe at a black person. But I thought that was important too. Other folks that we've not heard from at all have commentary that they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the hosts, the callers, and the listeners.
Oh, you want to make sure you get that commentary about the my fault for the interruption, but you were talking with us, workplace racism, about Bay Area scholars' commentary about Jews. Do you want to give us that? Because that would work today.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
For sure.
So what I was going to say about the Germans, the Nazi Germany, white people there, they basically, Nazi Germany, it's just about killing black people. And as has been discussed before, Jews have some black blood. The so-called Jews have black blood. That's why their hair curls. That's why their nose is big. That's why their color's different. But I wanted to say something about, okay, so the scholar from the Bay Area had mentioned a genocide that happened in Northern Africa. And I was going to say that, well, there was also one that happened in Southern Africa, in Namibia, if I'm saying that right. And what I was going to say to the young scholar and other scholars is just to study and to figure out when the white people go to battle, because I've noticed that they go to battle during the winter. And a lot of times they go to battle during the winter, but this is because of their genetics, being albinos. And in Namibia, if I'm saying that correctly again, in this country, after the ice albinos had come into the area and settled, when they started war, I think they started in December, when they went to war with the I can't say the name of the tribe correctly at the moment, but they went to war with them in December and then January, and then held off for a while, and then started back again in August. But the reason they start back again in August is so as the war continues, it will go back into the cold months. They'll be the months that are difficult for the black people to fight. They do everything tactically. Everything they do makes sense. And I just wanted to point that out, because when we try to figure out what they're going to do with us in this present day, they'll probably do what they've been doing. They'll probably attack us when we're at our weakest points, like when it's cold outside. And I was wanting people, I just want to say, people who are studying biology, if you could find out what are the weaknesses of these ice albinos? What are the weaknesses of these white people? Some of the weaknesses that I've come up with so far is the sun is the most evident weakness that I can think of. The sun and the heat that the sun produces, or the heat that we can produce, is a weakness that they have. Just being albino, that's why we sent them over into the northern part where the ice was, or either they went there or we sent them there. Either way, they were there and able to reproduce in such high numbers because of that cold environment and being isolated in that area. But so the sun is one weakness. Their depression seems to be a weakness of theirs. Drug use and addiction seems to be a weakness. Suicide seems to be a weakness, birth rate, loss of habitat, the globe is warming, and the ice where they've developed a good portion of their genetics. That's melting. It's been melting. So they're losing their habitat. Creatures who leave their habitat die, right? So, and also another weakness that they have that may be a strength but could also be a weakness is that they pay attention to black people. Because they pay attention to black people, we can use their attention and attack them, even with our words, because words, because you can make people do things with your words. And so for black women, I hear that women are better with words than men. You know, if that's the case, cool. So black women, you know, we're going to need you to help with this psychological warfare to end the system. But black men too. But we can use our words to stop them and to stop their reproduction even. Another thing that I was going to say is that back to the loss of habitat, I call them ice albinos because this is the most accurate term that I think I can come up with. It gives them a location. It gives them a time frame, their habitat, and also their genetics. It makes a reference to all of that. If we're able to eliminate the ice, we'll be able to eliminate the people, I think. And I could be wrong, but that's one thing that they're really concerned with is global warming. And there's one guy called McPherson. I heard that name in the clips, but that's not the same person. But this individual, white person named McPherson said that in 10 years humans are going to go extinct because of global warming. And then just because of global warming, the ice will melt in the northern regions, rising the sea levels, making the whole planet warmer. But they're saying that it's going to kill. This guy is saying it's going to kill all humans. Or he says 90% of the humans, or something like that. I don't think that's going to happen. But he's definitely saying that it's going to take out the white people. But I think that we should go ahead and eliminate their habitat. We could probably start fires in the northwestern hemisphere of America, and it will likely, because of the winds, take out the ice, move inland. Thank you.
Other folks that dialed in that we have not heard from, if you have a comment, question, you want to share, feel free. Folks we have not heard from at all, line should be open. Always grand when people have.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Good to hear from you, princess.
Yes, good evening. I was calling in real quick because I have to go to bed because I'm a little bit tired. But I was calling in real quick because I heard a little bit about the one of the callers was sharing her information about her son's college and education, and I just always suspected that ever since that they started looking into making college for free in like places, I believe recently San Francisco had announced that they're going to be making their colleges and stuff free and things like that. Primarily, I just think it's more geared towards giving more white people a handout and giving them a better advantage, while you have hundreds of thousands of mostly black people, black students that are in debt, and the fact that they just recently announced that they're going to be taking a more aggressive stance towards this whole student loan business, the fact that I guess the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVoe, she has ties to some of these companies that the Department of Education uses to as far as, you know, them going after student loan debt and stuff. So, you know, that's a conflict of interest right there. But I just I find it interesting as I was listening to her talk about what's going on in New York. It kind of just made sense to say, oh, okay, they're going to give, you know, white people, you know, a free handout in education, but we're sacked with debt, student loan debt. And, you know, Memorial Day, I've never really been into. I'm not sure as to why a lot of black people are. I mean, I know I come from a military family, but I've just always had my stance when it comes to the military. And I just think as far as, like, I've always just looked at, like, military recruitment centers are no different from abortion clinics in that basically they're taking the youth out of a community and sending them to death or killing them. And I have some stuff with my workplace racism that's playing out, but I'll probably save that to later in this week, hopefully if I have time. Princess has not been doing so well as far as health physically because of the system is not allowing me to get my proper care for my ongoing recovery from my surgery. So that's been a challenge in itself, just being able to have the time that I had before I had to move from my former location to this craziness, not being able to have the time to be able to do that. But I'll make the effort. But...
Wow.
That'll be all.
Health is super important. I'm sorry to hear that your health has been suffering acutely because of racism, white supremacy. I know you'd shared with us before about the different ways that they had just made it so difficult for you to get, you know, proper access to a physician, and then doing a lot of unnecessary traveling that could have been avoided, and just, you know, nothing, doing everything the wrong way so that you're not able to heal, recuperate, and move on with your life, which is standard operating procedure. So, yeah. And man, when your health gets compromised like that, man, that just messes everything up. When you're not comfortable, when you're in pain, that just, oh man. So I empathize, and I hope you're able to get that corrected. And yeah, if you want to update or share, workplace racism is every Thursday. Feel free, certainly, to share with us today. But, you know, if you have time and want to share, I'm sure folks, if anyone has any suggestions, we might even have some folks who have some better expertise in dealing with that sort of thing to offer any suggestions. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have questions, comments, observations, feel free.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Good to hear from you, Thomas, in New York.
Good to hear from you too, as well, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I've had a few observations from the clips. And first, I want to say to the brother who spoke a few minutes ago, what they call global warming, what white people call global warming, it doesn't add up, because all of the planets in the solar system are heating up at the same time, at the same amount, to the same level. So it's not global, the warming. It's coming, it's almost like a universal warming. So I just think we're going through a sun cycle that's coming up, and this stuff is going to melt, and eventually we'll come back as well in thousands of years from now, but just a cycle. I just don't think that global warming is the right word choice, being that Mars, Pluto, Venus, all of them are heating up at the same time. It's not just here. It's not global. Not, you know, Earth. The clip with the 3D printed ovaries, I found that to be very interesting. That's just, you know, you talk about mad scientists. I mean, that's amazing. I've seen a 3D printer at work, at one of the jobs, that it was pretty much, this was a law firm that dealt with copyrights and patents. And the companies were afraid that when these 3D printers come out, that no one would go to the store and buy their products anymore. They could just print them out themselves with the 3D printer. So they were coming up with ways to try to pretty much sell the dimensions of the products that they make, and they sell in the stores. Sell the dimensions so that way you'll buy it from the 3D printer. You'll actually be buying it from them, but it'll print out exactly to their specifications. It was very complicated in the early stages, but that's along the lines of where they're going. And the fact that they could print out organs now, in particular, is as valuable as ovaries. I mean, that's just amazing. That's one of those... You got to shake your head sometimes with stuff white people can do. And what if they could use it for this, for good things like, you know, having babies, which not white people having babies isn't a good thing, but if they could use it for good things, imagine the harm they're going to be using these 3D printers for as well. It's just endless possibilities. Bill Cosby, you know, I hate that clip because the white people kept trying to tell how black people think, and I really hate when white people do that, because I find that they kind of put us in a box, try to put us in a box to think the way they want us to think, how they think, if that makes sense to you. If it doesn't, don't try to make sense out of it. Either way, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about things that Bill Cosby said about black people, and I have yet to find anyone that disagreed with him. However, I have found people that didn't like how and where he made those statements at, you know, in the venue he used, you know, mainstream media, white media, to make those comments. But I think everyone agreed with the comments he made, it's just how he did it. So I don't think Bill Cosby, per se, is coming back to the black community at like a OJ-type situation. Bill Cosby didn't have a white wife. You know, Bill Cosby did do things in the black community all these years. He has sent kids to college. I mean, his record in the black community, he's shown a lot of, like I said, I don't like the fact that he went to the mainstream media, but he's done a lot of things that exemplify black self-respect. And I don't think that it's the same type of situation, even though from listening to the clip, that's how white people want to position it. The last thing I wanted to say about the race riots in East St. Louis, just from listening to the gentleman discuss that and hearing that clip, you see, when white people do it, that's a riot, you know. Hanging people, it was some black self-respect with black organizations defending some of the black areas, which, you know, was great, but When they riot, it's very little that can be done to stop them, you know. So when we riot, it's pretty much staged off into an area that they designate for us to do it in. They set the cameras up right there. I mean, I guarantee you, it wasn't going to be no cameraman standing around while they're lynching people. You know, that's going to be done. I mean, they go all out. So I just think that was a great clip because, you know, it shows, you know, who really does the rioting. And I'm hitting my line. Thank you.
Right on. I thought that was such a really important point about the Cosby situation not being. I did also want to make sure that I got in. Everyone did not agree with what Bill Cosby has said, because he said so many things over the years. If you want to do a little searching for fun, there's a documentary, Boys of Baraka, and Mr. Cosby is in the documentary, and he has commentary. These are white females, I believe white females who identify as lesbians, who did this documentary about
the poor niggers in Baltimore, Maryland. And Mr. Cosby is in the bonus footage for this documentary. I certainly didn't agree with what he had to say there. Anyway, Mr. Cosby publicly said that he thought HIV/AIDS was a conspiracy against black people. That is about as far away from O.J. Simpson as you can get. Like, he is publicly on record as having said that, along with a lot of other things that show that he, hey, this is somebody who has said consistently that he thinks racism is a problem, specifically for black people, not morphing into a whole lot of, I mean, wow, he has said a lot of things. I would say, yeah, you can go on record. I don't think it would be comparable to say he's doing something like O.J. Simpson or coming back to black people. I don't think that would apply to Bill Cosby at all. And again, emphasizing that I did not agree with a lot of things that he said, but VGQ, the problem is still white people. Other folks we've not heard from at all. Folks we haven't heard from at all. Always grand when people call in with a hand up and then they don't talk. I guess some people could be in areas where maybe they can't, it's not quiet, so they can't speak quite yet. Let me see, there was.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is Red from Ohio. I just have a few observations. I can't remember which caller had asked the question or made a comment about the whole liquor stores having locks on all their bottles. I actually made an observation. I was today about that. I was purchasing some alcohol for some family members, and in one store, a store that's closer, I guess, to black people, there were basically locks on all the alcohol, just nearly every single bottle. But then I went to another store for another relative, like later on in the day, and closer to, like, I guess what you would call white area, and they didn't have any locks on any bottles. So I feel like it's definitely just how with the other gentleman or the other black male, he was talking about just the locks being on do-rags. They do that in reference, whites do that as far as how close the items are to black people. And also here in Ohio, we do have some locations where they do abide by not selling alcohol on Sundays, not endorsing the drinking of alcohol, but just wanted to make the comment on the previous caller's comments. I've thought one of the white mothers in the segment about the, I guess, half black children in England, how I think I must have missed part of the clip where I think maybe the I guess you could correct me if I'm wrong, where I guess it was black soldiers having sex with white women and producing these children. And the black female or the half-black female, she had said how she was told her mother really loved the black male and that was the only person who she ever loved. I found that was definitely odd, to say the least. I don't, not just following Mr. Neely Fuller's suggestion as far as when white people get with non-whites, they're automatically racist, but the fact that if she loved that black male so much, why would she not at least even tell her daughter on her deathbed or sometime leave her some type of indication of who that black male was or how she can kind of find him or anything of that nature. So I just think that that was definitely false. When they were talking about the St. Louis uprisings, I did like how I think it was a black male when he was being interviewed about it, he did call it an uprising and not a riot. The term was used permanently exiled, and I looked up exile, which was under, you know, you can't return to wherever you were under threat of you know, death, what have you. I didn't really know what permanently exile meant, and I felt like it could have went into maybe a little bit more detail about that. I did Google, during the segment, I did Google the uprising, and I actually put in Google St. Louis uprising, the 20th century, and it still pulled up links that said St. Louis riot. So it just goes to show, I feel like there have been talks about how Google is really trying to make sure they're not as, the search engine is not as racist, but then they also say, well, they can't help it if, you know, if the searches pull up racist things. But I kind of felt like they're not really making that much of a difference. I did want to, I guess, somewhat of an update about the Kirkersville, Ohio nursing home shooting that I spoke about a few weeks ago, or maybe last week, what have you. I was looking up on different news sites because just to see if the information kind of went together, if all the news sites basically had the same information. But the one thing that they're really leaving out is the fact that Thomas Heartless, that was the white man who shot the three people, including his ex-girlfriend, worker of the nursing home, and a police officer. They are all, most of the news sites, 90% of them at least, are neglecting the fact that he had told his girlfriend, the one that he killed, that he didn't like police. They're not calling him a cop killer. They're not, you know, saying anything, of course, bad about him. And I understand it should not be a surprise because, of course, the media is racist. The last thing that, I guess that was it. That's all I have for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
M1 would really appreciate that. About the, and again, words, just what words are used, like you were talking about what results came up when you put in uprising. But yeah, he would really appreciate that because he's noted that same pattern when whites, you know, go out and commit violence or talk about committing violence, even against police officers, that it just is not, they don't use the same words to describe those acts when it's a black person that is alleged to have committed similar type crimes. They become, you know, the greatest terrorists since, you know, bin Laden. Other folks that we've not heard from at all have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I believe that I heard the audio segment. I think, was that St. Olaf University, I think, Gus?
Yes, sir. It reminded me when you said Western white from last week. I was like, oh, there's this term.
Yeah, because I was wondering whether that, I never even heard that term myself, so that definitely brought alert to my mind. And that question that I think the interviewer asked at the end, is this campus racist? You know, I noticed that they'll use something that don't refer to people, and they'll apply it to racism, like, well, is this building racist? Or, you know, they'll, like, white people are more so ask a victim if something that's not a person, a, you know, is racist or whatnot, rather than what they say is a particular white person a racist. I picked up on that pattern as well. And yeah, a lot of the terms in that clip was very interesting. And I think another thing that I caught on to was the spinning into butter audio where, you know, the guy asked, like, what's going to happen or whatever, and the lady says, we're having a race for him. And he says, well, what is that? And, you know, a formal race like that, like, you know, the wordplay, like she using the same words to describe what she was asked about. Like she said, a form on race. And then, then she already said race form. Like, I wonder if they do that very often. Like, that could be another like trick or whatever. And another story I had read up on was something that I think it's called Menomonee High School. It's spelled Menomonie. I guess it's in Wisconsin. And like this, like they had something put in a yearbook, and they used the term code, like it was a coded message, and it spelled out "I hate blacks." But the I guess whoever this kid was, he had it written out as IB has a tiny earning, but leaves a crisp kid satisfied. So the first letter of every word spells out I hate blacks, like IHATEBLACKS. So very sophisticated to put that into a yearbook. And I guess people was just looking through it and they said, hey, you know, I decoded this message, you know, what's going on here? So people was acting surprised, like they didn't think that it was in there, or, you know, they didn't understand how to just make it through people's you know, perceptions or whatever. So very interesting story that I came upon to look at. And that's pretty much all I have right now. Thank you.
Wow. Once again, racist man, racist woman, racist child, none of them. 8 to 88, they are not ignorant about racism. Wow. What a code. Other folks we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy.
Greetings. I wanted to speak briefly about what's going on with Bill Cosby. I don't know what the final outcome will be, and I really am not well informed enough to know if he did anything or did not do anything. I do know that, like the clip did say, that not everybody is being held to the same standard. Trump did get elected, and he said many things. He admitted many things. But more importantly, I specifically remember before hearing about Bill Cosby, about the white man who played the father in Seventh Heaven. And he admitted on tape that he was molesting children. And I haven't heard anything else about it whatsoever. I even still see Seventh Heaven, like, on the TV listening, like, it will play. And there's no big, maybe he did go to court, maybe he didn't, maybe he settled, but nothing. No hubbub about it, no dragging his name through the mud or, like, defaming him or anything like that. So I'm not sure exactly really why this is being such a big deal, other than the fact that it is Bill Cosby and he is black. And when I say that he is Bill Cosby, I believe he is one of the first to have created a healthy family image for black people that is ingrained in the mind of many, many black people. When we think of what a black family would look like and feel like and be like, we think of the Cosbys. There are many others, but the Cosbys would be like a prototype. And so it's really just a defamation of his legacy. But I think that in the same way that white people protect their white people, we should protect our black people. It is irrefutable fact how many of these white men who are held in such high esteem were rapists and pedophiles. And it's okay. Like, it's like a little sentence, and it's like, but they still founded the nation. Well, no, you know what I mean? So even if this turns out that where he becomes, they say that he's guilty, it will not change for me, and I am a black female, what he did. And I did feel this way, and I think the same thing, making sure I'm paying attention to the word choice there, with Nate Parker and the Birth of a Nation film. I'm not going to say that that film changed the discourse of conversations around racism. I don't think that it created a paradigm shift in racism, but I do think that it did something. And I think it's the first film like it. It's the first film about Nat Turner. And so even though they tried to bring up that allegation with that white woman who committed suicide, so what? I don't think that any non-white person, specifically black person, and even more specifically black males, should be lynched because of whatever might be in their past. Not to mention, I wanted to mention this really big difference. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not saying anybody is any fault, like it's anybody's fault. You know, you got slipped drugs or whatever, like that is not your fault at all. I'm also going to say that, you know, they're not children in the same way that the Seven Heavens father, the father of the Seventh Heaven show, like I forget his name. That's the only reason I keep calling him that. But those are like children. And then you have women who are seeking the attention of these men or putting themselves, like they're at Hugh Hefner's house. You know what I'm saying? I'm not blaming them and saying it's their fault. I'm just saying there should be a level of context that, you know, wasn't like some, you know, I don't know. Let me not even go that far. But there are clauses, there are contracts. Women are found for this. They share stories. Like, women are doing whatever they're doing to reach whatever status that they want to reach and have access to whatever they want to have access and be around the famous people and then, you know, turn around and say something. So anyway, moving on. It is called Namibia. You said it correctly, just in case no one ever tells you. You don't have to keep saying that it is Namibia. I think, like, I was considering the same thing because melanin is very strong. That's a biological fact that we have melanin. I think that that's something that white people are very much paying a lot of attention to and they want. So, but I think that on a psychological principle, because I haven't determined what their biological weakness is. Hello? What's that?
I think somebody shifted. Yes, ma'am. Sorry about
okay.
that.
Okay, cool. No worries. Just making sure I can still be heard and it's not me. But I think that on a psychological principle, that the feeling of power is their weakness. I feel that, I observe that in dealing with white people. If you constantly make them feel that they're in power, whether that's true or not, but in that moment that they're interacting with you, that is something that they need. If you take that away, it shifts their face and you can begin to see behind their face. I'll continue to think about your question. I always appreciate when you ask questions and you comment. So I think I'm new. I'm not like a biologist or anything like that, but I do try to take everything that I learn and find to piece it and put it into some kind of context so that I can understand things better. I think that maybe the heat could be due to the, you know, thermodynamic principle of entropy. I don't know what that would mean, but, you know, that's like how we get energy and stuff like that. So maybe there's something to do with that, but it doesn't change the fact that they don't do well with the heat. And I don't think that we can deny that the ozone layer, I think, or that the fact that there are so many chemicals in the air does something. What it is, I'm not so sure, because most of our science, we are taken from, like, white people, and I don't know, they lie so much, they could be lying about that. I think, like, the technology thing with the ovaries, I'm not with it at all. I think that was just how you should die out. Like, that's, like, if they're such scientists, like, that's what it is. They don't adapt. You're going to die out. Like, that's the point of this all. And I think that they know that. I don't know if the more powerful whites have really, like, shared that with the less powerful whites, but I think white people know that they are going to die out. And I think that might be what this whole push is with the interbreeding with us. They might have determined to some level, well, we need to have some that we need to graft in their genetics. But I'm not with it. And whenever I hear anything about the technology, I think about the cost that that is on everybody and everything else that's non-white. That technology, the minerals, the resources, all of that has to come from someplace. That printer isn't printing the own minerals to make itself again, which means that it's not benefiting us, but it's killing us at the same time. Thank you, guys. I didn't hear that about the prostitute thing. And then I wanted to just ask, because it's something that I'm practicing, it's something that I've been practicing, it's something that I observe, the eye contact. I guess I could pose a question now, but it's also like a future question. If you are someone who's been doing that or trying to do that, your observations in doing that in terms of yourself, but really what you observe in other people, I find that the moment I make eye contact and I keep the eye contact, there's a whole nonverbal communication with the expectation that I'm supposed to look away. And I think that this is so important because I think that the thing that will benefit non-white people is going to go back to the basics. We don't have the resources or the money or whatever to be trying to compete in this like technological way. But I think that there's some of these basics that we've just kind of accepted as normal when they're not normal. And if we kind of paid more attention to the real foundational elements of certain things, we'd be able to see things clear and begin to see our creative way of replacing a system of white supremacy with a system of justice. So I think eye contact, nonverbal communication, why I focus so much attention on it, is one of those foundational fundamental basics that I like to focus on. And so anyway, no matter if the person is white or non-white but not black, this whole like eye contact thing is very interesting. I observe it constantly. And that is very uncomfortable for everybody, and they'll just keep staring like they're waiting for you to look away. And so if anyone has like any experience, observations, I'm open and I'd like to hear them. But with that, I'll jump off. So thank you all for listening.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, time is winding down. Other folks we haven't heard from have commentary. Anyone that we missed?
I'm not in a good place to talk.
Oh, okay. Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Anybody else that we missed completely? Making sure I didn't miss any hands. I will assume that we got everyone. I'll double check on the switchboard to make sure I didn't miss any hands as well. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. So we got, there's nobody that we missed completely. All right, we'll pick them up down the road if that is the case. Anybody have an additional comment that they wanted to make sure they got in as well? Answer any of the questions that have been posed?
Actually, I almost forgot to say something about why I focus so much on the eye contact. Sorry, I'm trying to make sure I say it in the five, and now that there's a little bit of time, I'd like to just quickly say it, that the eye contact, whether it's in humans or other, you know, animals, but non-human animals, that the eye contact is a denotation of power. And so the constant looking down and looking away and avoiding eye contact is a constant reinforcement of a superior or a inferior position to whomever you are looking away from, who you are saying is in a superior position. Also, it is a way of like, it's a way of pretty much saying that you feel bad or you don't feel as good. You don't hold yourself in as much high esteem to be able to maintain the eye contact and, you know, figure this whole thing out. By looking down and looking away, we, you know, are missing a lot of cues. And that's not good. We're missing a lot of cues, and I think that's how sometimes we end up in really, really bad situations. By maintaining that eye contact, we, you know, on an animal instinctual level are saying, well, I'm vulnerable and, you know, you're the one that can do whatever to me. I'm not really looking at you. And I don't think that we are maybe intentionally saying that, but it's been so programmed within us that that is what we are acting out. And then the other thing I wanted to say, just for any of the black men, again, I'm a black female, for any of the black men, it's a tragedy what happened to the young man at UMD. I'm over in the DMV area, which means that, like, right now I'm probably maybe 35 minutes away from their campus. Moving out the way or not having that fight or not doing that is not being, not having self-respect, because we don't want you to die. So I know, like, you know, men would be like, you know, nah, this, that, and the third. But by moving to the side and, like, not dealing with these are not people who have the same kind of code or the same kind of understanding. And at any moment, I think they could all be carrying a knife and be doing whatever and be hyped. Like, just, you know, let that white person go instead of dealing with that confrontation, because it's never going to end well, I think, for the non-white, specifically black man. And I just wanted to say that, because sometimes I think the black men will feel like that they're not being men if they, like, let that go. I'm going to say you can let that go, because we want to come home. That's it. Thank you.
Well said. Well said. I just wanted to get this in. I was speaking with a listener, and the person said that their mother, I guess, had some, she was hesitant, her mom seeing, I guess she was going to ask a question, right? They were paying for a service at a business, and she was going to ask a question. And her mom's just like, oh, man, you know, there you go questioning white folks again, basically. And she was like, man, we're, you know, getting a service. It's not like I'm going to ask him if he's had, you know, intercourse with a non-white person or something. I'm just asking about, I am paying for this, you know, what am I paying for exactly? Like, I think that's legit. And I was just like, you know, that's how we've been terrorized. That is victim of the system of white supremacy, because that was a part of the code, the racist white supremacist code. That, you know, if you're a black person, you can't look at a white person. You can't have eye contact with a white person. You could be castrated for that. You know, you can't question a white person. You can't even walk on the same. Forget on the sidewalk. It's in the warmth of other suns. The gorgeous Isabel Wilkerson. It's in the warmth of other suns that we read. You might have to cross to the other side of the street, not just move left, like get across the road, nigra. That was like white supremacy codes. I mean, to have that go on for generations and to have this happen to a 17 because he didn't move fast enough. And again, Emmy's point, well said, white people are dangerous. I think I did miss some people, hands up, that were on the switchboard. So any people want to make an opportunity? Anyone we have not heard from? Folks have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Hello, can I be heard?
I heard both of you. I'll get Mr. Steele second, the male caller that spoke up first.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the other callers and listeners. Really enjoyed the conversation you had with Pam this week on Sunday, Wednesday. And also talking about different issues about tragic relationships. But in regards to that, I wanted to inform you guys about a flyer that has been going around the Chicagoland area particularly in the black neighborhoods, particularly in regards to calling out or turning in undocumented and illegal immigrants. The title of the flyer is called ICEM, and it says ICEEM, and it says sanctuary city policies endanger the livelihood of every American while violating federal law and destroying the black community. Studies by the Democratic Black Caucus have found that illegal immigrants create a burden in the black community and economy. Majority are paid under the table. 72% of illegal jobs are biggest in construction and factory workers right here in Chicago. Then they got a reward out, $3,000 to $10,000 per illegal reported. And then they got a list of companies that they say that are hiring illegal immigrants. And so, you know, they got the ICE number, Department of Homeland Security number, and basically at the bottom it says, help Attorney General Jeff Sessions help U.S. black people. This is just so interesting how white supremacy, you know, basically uses, you know, non-white people against non-white people, and especially, you know, in this case, you know, they're, you know, trying to use black people against the, you know, against the non-white, you know, Mexicans and, you know, whoever, Latinos are in this city, but like I said, we don't know where these flyers are coming from. I know they're basically not coming from, you know, ICE or DHS, but you know, it's I guess in the age of Trump, you know, anything is possible. So I just wanted to report that, and I will mute my line.
Wow. Sounds like Mr. Fuller's concept of snitching, as he has it outlined in the code book. Mr. Steele, thank you for your patience. Do you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I am currently in the city of Pomona, and I just wanted to start out this week by pointing out that these white supremacists are operating at a level that many of us are not fully aware of. And I suspect that We can, and it's a global system, and this is something that we're all aware of, and something that I don't know has been discussed tonight, or rather, I'm not sure if I've heard it being discussed, is the recent, what they're calling terrorist attack that took place in Manchester in the United Kingdom at an Ariana Grande concert. And the coverage, one thing that I've done recently is I've taken a real keen interest in the news that's being reported in the United Kingdom, because I've seen that many of the attitudes and sentiments that are held by the racists over there are shared by the racists over here, and they seem to be coordinating with each other, at least politically speaking. We saw that the Brexit vote foreshadowed the victory of Donald Trump. And one thing that I want victims over here to notice is how the racists in the United Kingdom are reacting to this most recent incident that they are calling terrorism. They are publishing article after article after article in all of their publications that seem to be indicting large swaths of what appears to be non-white people who are black. And they have become very uncodified in their manner of discussing what they want to do with people that they suspect are terrorists, especially those of them who are non-white and those who are classified as black. So pay very, very close attention. They're discussing, you know, they're blaming terrorism on what they call terrorism on weed. They're saying that they're going back to Libya and saying that the associates of this alleged terrorists are rapists. They're using the rape word a lot, actually, and they're actually using the term explicitly gang rape to describe some of the activities of the people that are associated with the person that they assert to be a terrorist. So please pay very close attention. Also, over this weekend, and you know, just generally going forward, pay very, very close attention to racist white supremacists or people you suspect are racist white supremacists. I heard one caller say, suggest that we not avert our eyes when we're in their presence. Practice looking at them in the eye. Practice keeping their eye on you. Practice monitoring them. Practice reporting them. If you are in a situation, I heard a victim recently recall a situation where a suspected racist was engaging them in an Uber as a driver. They were talking about, you know, how they support Trump and this, that, and a whole host of other talking points that are shared by racists. I suggested to this victim that you report that. And me personally, I've had four Uber drivers removed from the service for practicing what I suspect is racism. So practice reporting these people, practice monitoring these people, practice paying attention to these people, practice looking at these people. Again, ask yourself at the end of the day, did I question or contradict a racist today? And if the answer is no, make sure that you find an opportunity in the next day to do even that basic function. And I will mute my line at this time. Thank you for the for this platform. And please be safe this afternoon. Stay away from large groups of suspected racists, and don't let them come to your party if they invite themselves. Thank you.
Amen. I think when she mentioned Seventh Heaven, Stephen Collins, I think, is the suspected racist and I guess suspected child rapist that she was referencing, I believe, Stephen Collins. The caller that just spoke up, yes, we can hear you.
Yes. I would like to comment on what I observed from Donald Trump after the bombing over there in Great Britain. And what I noticed about Donald Trump, how he talked about slaughter of the innocents. He kept talking about the innocents a lot. And for some reason, that just made me think about them. And I heard a lot of other people say that word, of the innocents, you know, and it kind of made me think of them saying, like, slaughter of the whites. You know, they were relating innocent equal white. Even when he said all of the people that were killed, if you pay close attention to that speech he said and you look at it again, you could even see him saying that all of those people that died were not innocent. He said some of them were innocent. And I could be wrong, but I remember clearly hearing him saying some of them were innocent. And another thing that kind of caught my attention during that speech, when he was talking about people that they need to get rid of, they need to do away with. And he didn't say some of them. He stressed it. He said we need to get rid of every single one of them. And he said we need to get rid of a culture of people that call themselves monsters. See, I'm not going to call them monsters. I'm going to call them losers. Because if I call them monsters, they'll take pride in it. Now, he's talking about a culture of people that call themselves monsters. But we live in a culture that says savage, ratchet. You know, just to me, it was a lot of cold words that he was throwing out there. And I could be wrong, you know. But I thought that he was really kind of bringing it back to his problem that he got in the main 48 where he lives. You see what I'm saying? Well, their main target is really descendants of slaves, not, you know, people over there. You know what I'm saying? So, but all of them are focusing on non-white people globally. But I could be wrong. And I have one more thing to say, too. I have personal gripe with Post. They have a group that they call Black Voices. You know, the white supremacists, I guess, allow all type of groups. They got a homosexual page. They got a feminist page. And they have a page for Black Voices. Now, I noticed when I read Black Voices, I would see issues about gay rights. And then I see issues about feminist stuff. But I wonder, do they share with the genocide of black people on the gay people page with the Huffington Post, or the feminist page with the Huffington Post? And the second thing is that they talk more about homosexuality and feminism than they talk about reparations for the descendants of slaves. And I'll mute my line, and thank you for letting me get what's on my chest off. Thank you.
For sure. I guess I didn't hear it correctly. I thought you said you had a gripe with the host, and then you were talking about Black Voices and your observations. Like, oh, he must have said something. I must not have heard him correctly.
I said the host.
Oh, I got you. I got you. I just didn't hear it correctly. Got it. I'm correct now. Thank you for the clarification. Appreciate that caller in Alabama. A lot of listeners always appreciate your commentary as well. Did we miss anybody? Anybody has a hand up that I missed completely? Got everybody. Spectacular. Do other folks have commentary? Any additional commentary that they wanted to get in, even if you have already shared?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just real quick. I also wanted to make a comment about the Cosby situation and the Sheriff Clark situation. Now, these are two very similar situations in that these are two highly showcased victims of racism that the racists have, I suspect, purposely put in positions where they will be publicly humiliated. And one technique that I've seen that these racists are using for certain victims of racism that they showcase is that they will alienate these victims from other victims. They will use their media apparatus to frame their behavior in a way that it will look deliberately anti-Black or deliberately framed in a way that they are aware that a majority of Black people do not appreciate. And I want to stress that these people are still victims of racism, despite what your opinion on what they have said or done in the past may be. They are still victims of this system of racism, white supremacy. What they are experiencing, the heightened scrutiny that they are under, the threat of loss of income or the destruction of their ability to generate income, it's all wrapped up within this system of racism. I'm not saying that these people are perfect or that there is any example of any perfect Black person. This system turns us all into what has been called monsters and monstrosities by some victims that are more learned on the subject than I am. But please, please understand that whatever you may feel about these people and what your opinions may be, these people are being subject to some of the most sophisticated examples of racism, white supremacy. And when these people are getting their so-called wake-up call, that understand that that sort of activity can happen to you tomorrow. And the fact that it's happening to them should make you understand that it's even more likely to occur to you should you befall any sort of questionable circumstances. So please, please, please understand that the enemy is racism, white supremacy. That is the problem, and that the victims of racism, white supremacy, they are not the problem. Thank you.
We had, appreciate that, Mr. Steele. We had a listener. She wrote in. She said, a question came to mind while remembering a statement that Dr. Welsing made during an interview in the context of racism, white supremacy. What does the phrase "have the courage of your convictions" mean? Thank you in advance to anyone that is willing to share their view. If folks have commentary, feel free. When I read this, it reminded me of the late Dr. Maya Angelou. We read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings the year that she transitioned. And when we were reading the book, one of the important phrases that stood out that I guess she shared this with a lot of people, because many folks, I think Oprah Winfrey and Melissa Harris Perry, quite a few folks I've heard have mentioned that Dr. Angelou said this to them. She said that the most important virtue is courage, because you cannot practice any of your other beliefs, convictions, if you will. You can't practice them consistently if you don't have courage. And those, whatever your convictions, values are, they don't mean anything without being practiced consistently. And you'll need courage to do it. I'm paraphrasing, but that's close, very close, I think, to the sentiment of what she was sharing. And that's what came to mind when this question was asked about the phrase, have the courage of your convictions, meaning, you know, you have to be demonstrating whatever your convictions are. You have to be demonstrating them on a consistent daily basis. If your conviction is that the system of white supremacy should be replaced immediately, that should be evidenced in your behavior on a regular basis. We had another listener. She had a family member in greater confinement in the New York area. And I think the gist of the problem, I am not a scholar or an expert on the what they call criminal justice system, and certainly not in New York State, because these laws and things tend to vary by region. But I think she had a family member who's in greater confinement, and she just wanted resources, help with understanding that process and just trying to get help for this family member in greater confinement. So if anyone, particularly any listeners in the New York area or folks who have resources, knowledge that might be helpful, you can just drop me an email and I will forward it along. I'm sure she would appreciate. We have about 10 minutes. Anybody, any other comments, questions that they want to get in, or responses to questions that have been posed?
Yeah, I had a response.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Elise first.
Thank you. This is Fred again. I just wanted to actually thank the caller. I think it was, I'm sorry, somewhere down south. He mentioned the whole fact of linking together, like savage, using the word savage, and all types of things that we tend to call ourselves. And I actually recently had a conversation with two other black females about having some type of feeling of honor by being called a female dog. And I didn't try to push the subject too much, but it definitely made me think about that and how it's definitely being emphasized that we should be calling ourselves animals and dogs and savages and whatever else. So I definitely wanted to thank him for pointing that out, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Thomas in New York?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment to what the guy asked earlier about the do-rags being locked away. Now, the only reason why I could see a major store locking away something so invaluable as a do-rag is because they want to inconvenience the people who would normally come in and buy a do-rag so that they don't know, maybe will go somewhere else to get it. You know, they don't want to have to wait for someone to come with the keys to unlock it. And, you know, so probably to do away with having Negroes coming in just to spend $2 on a do-rag, we lock it away, and then the word was spread that it's, you know, they're better off just going to their local convenience store to get it. What I noticed that they do here in New York, I'm from Jersey, Jersey City, and in New York City, up here in Harlem, we go to the store, some stores, it's gotten a lot better. But when I first moved up here, you would literally go into a store and not be able to touch any of the products. Everything's locked away behind a see-through bulletproof glass. You had to kind of point to what you wanted, and, you know, the person would come and they'll slide it through a little section after you paid them. I think just that one of the things that they do to us is, just try to inconvenience us in every way that they can. I'm with my mom. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Hang on 1 second. The caller at 3246. 3246, did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. I was going to say to the lady who was talking about the reckless eyeballing or the looking white people in the eye. Yeah, I do that, and I have noticed their behavior. Usually, first they'll just stand firm, like, you know, they keep their feet still, like in a stance, like you can't push them over type, like a fighting stance, and they look you in your eye. I look them in their eyes, and then they kind of do like their eyebrows squinch together like an angry face. I just keep looking at them. And eventually they'll look down and they'll look at me again, and they'll try to get me to look down, and we'll just keep looking at each other, and then they'll walk away. And even there was a bouncer at a club. I wasn't going in. I was dropping a lady off, and a white bouncer at a black quote unquote owned bar, and I was just standing face to face with this guy. We're just looking at each other. You know, I'm just dropping her off, but he's like, you know, looking past her, looking at me. And then eventually, you know, I just said, "What's good?" You know, in a aggressive tone. And he just, you know, he's looking at me. He said something to me, and we just keep looking at each other. But you know, I'm thinking, yeah, I'm a quicker draw, though. You know,
if it really has to come to that. But I just noticed that they'll just keep looking at you until eventually they'll stop. But they want to kill you. That's what they're trying to say, and that's what I'm saying to them. Hey, we want to kill each other. But anyway, what I was going to say about the global warming that Mr. Thomas in New York had mentioned, that may not be the best term, and yeah, there is interplanetary warming, like the old solar system's warming, probably like a solar cycle. But I have noticed they still are able to slow down the melt of the ice. I don't know that the melting the ice is actually going to solve anything, but I do think that we can superheat the atmosphere. And with it, they're doing like global dimming, which means they're putting a bunch of particles in the air to reflect the sunlight. They call that the albedo effect. If I'm saying that right, it's like how much white there is on the planet reflects the sun. Well, anyway, since they're doing that, it is reflecting the sun, making the Earth considerably cooler. They can't change it. They can't really change the stages of what's going to happen, but they can make the Earth cooler for a period of time. I'm saying, but since they're doing that global dimming, putting the particles in the air, that makes it a smaller closed system. If we were to heat up the atmosphere from the ground, it would probably cause some catastrophic events. I don't know if the math works out or not. I'm still trying to figure all that out. I just want this problem solved. I picture white people going through heat exhaustion and being spread out all over the world, just laid out on the ground, spread with their arms spread out and their legs spread out from heat exhaustion, and we didn't even fire a shot. I see that, and it comforts me. I hope that happens. Thanks.
May I be heard?
Yeah, I'm going to be heard.
Let's get the
lady go.
Awesome.
Oh, thank you. Just with regard to what I think it was Amy who was talking about, how, you know, the looks, how they look at you. Listen, that's just kind of one of them things that they do, and that kind of falls into the category of that stupid smile that they give you. You know, they look at you and they give you that stupid smile. So I get that a lot. So what I do is I look them dead in the eye, you know, and I shake my head from side to side. I give them a no. Like, no, I don't believe you a safe white person, and there's no reason for you to believe that I'm a safe nigga. So no, that's not going over. That's not going to make the situation any better. That's not going to make me walking past you any better. That's not going to make our standing in line together better. That's not going to make you standing there with your child in that cart any better. That little smile that you give me, I just look at them dead in the eye, and I shake my head from side to side. No, I just give them a no. Every preconceived notion that you have about what that smile may mean, because you were taught that by your mother and your father, no, your family does that. This is how you encounter black people. Just smile at them. No, everything is not okay. So, you know, that's just one of the things that I do. And, you know, you talked about your convictions. You know, Gus, about that question that person wrote into you. That's a conviction. You know, to not help them, that's a conviction. To let them know that everything is not okay in your little silent way, your codified way, that's a conviction. I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The other male caller that yielded the floor, were you going to comment?
Yeah, this is Cam in Wisconsin. I just wanted to comment about the do-rag thing. I did work in a store where... I mean, I worked in a strip mall, in a store, where in one of those places they did hide a lot of the black hair care products behind the glass. And so in a lot of those stores, they do have this tendency to think that black people do steal. And I was actually in a store where there was a lot of theft going on. And I do want to get into more commentary about this on workplace racism, about my whole tenure there. But basically, the black people were blamed, but it was actually ended up being two white people who stole thousands of dollars of merchandise, and all of the black people combined probably stole a net $0. And it was just amazing how there was no apologies for this afterwards. It was just, you know, it was like, get on with your work. And my second quick comment is about the conviction. And yes, I think earlier I said something about wanting justice, but not knowing the law of due process. And thus, I have see a lot of Black people who talk about justice, but in the same breath, will convict somebody who has not even been to trial. A lot of their information is based off just the hearing and all the information there. So as far as convictions, yes, I do think that anybody's concepts or speech is only really substantiated by the results and their behavior. And that's why when I talk to people about law, I try to make sure that I follow the law to the best of my abilities, and also be someone who can tell them the law, and not allow for the conversation to, you know, be illogical. I think it's very irresponsible for a conversation to not have any consequence if the logic is wrong. If it doesn't make sense, I like to ask a lot of questions because it's very irresponsible just be throwing words out there but not having any evidence or, you know, practice behind it. It really doesn't make sense. Otherwise, why do we pay attention to those words or any of those conversations in the first place when there's other work to be done? And that's all I had to say.
Very important. Very important. That is pretty much our 3 hours. We will be here, as I said, this coming Tuesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. White Male, Professor Willimon. He's at Duke University in North Carolina. His book, Who Lynched Willie Earl? And this is a lynching that happened in 1947, not ancient history. But he'll be on the program this Tuesday evening. We'll discuss his book. In the role that he personally admits to playing in the system of white supremacy. Looking forward to that. Always great to be able to ask a white person some questions. Folks have commentary, guest suggestions. If you can't find a broadcast in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Try to help out as best I can. I hope folks remain codified, remain safe. I will say it again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, particularly this weekend. I would be willing to bet my last dollar, say that again as well. They're probably going to have a good number of sobriety checkpoints out this weekend, and they tend to locate those in areas where the melanin is. So just have that in mind. If you, you know, got to consume your alcohol or whatever it is, get to one spot and stay. You do not want to be out riding around late at night. I think that situation with Richard Collins III, I think he was out not doing anything criminal, just saying that I think this happened later in the evening. And I've just said consistently, system of racism, white supremacy, whites, that's when we can be more aggressive. We can have that excuse or whatever it is. Just have that sort of thing in mind, particularly over this weekend and, you know, really for the duration of white supremacy. You do not want to be intoxicated and have that be the moment that you have to come in contact with Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, Betty Shelby, any of these other race soldiers, bad or no. Things can go bad very quickly. We want our brain computer operating at maximum efficiency so we can solve the problem, white people. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest level of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.